Testing.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
I'm going to start over, please.
Okay.
The House Taxation Committee will come to order. Will the secretary please call the roll?
Vice Chair Fern?
Here.
Vice Chair Welch?
Here.
Representative Abbott? Representative Brewster?
Here.
Representative Buckley?
Here.
Representative Dunwell?
Here.
Representative Fielder?
Here.
Representative Caleb Hinkle?
Here. Okay.
Representative Kazmaier?
Here.
Representative Kearns?
Committee will come to order.
Representative Rhonda Knudsen?
Here.
Representative Malone?
Here.
Representative Marler?
Here.
Representative Mitchell?
Here.
Representative Sheldon Galloway?
Here.
Representative Thane?
Here.
Representative Trebus?
Here.
Chair Beard?
Here. And we have a quorum. Let's see. First of all, I just want to remind everyone before we get started with the hearings is to silence your cell phones. Again, we do like delicious pastries and donuts. If you need to take a call, please step out into the hallway. And if you wish to give testimony on any of the three bill hearings that we are going to conduct this morning, please sign in at the door and then provide your name and affiliation, if any, and also your state of residence. Also, in order to be eligible to be on Zoom for your testimony, you will have had to sign in 24 hours in advance. Any information you provide during this hearing will be a matter of public record. And you can see on the whiteboard that we have three bills scheduled for this morning: House Bill 52, House Bill 17, House Bill 23. Does anyone have any rescheduled bills at this moment? Let me know. Thank you. All right, now we're going to start. We're going to open on House Bill 52, Vice Chair Welch.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question?
Representative Sheldon Galloway.
Thank you. If we go and become opponent or a proponent, do we stay as that till the end of the hearing, or do we come back to our seats and then are able to ask questions to other people that came to witness?
I would think it would be preferable to just, Megan, would you please respond to that question?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the procedures you adopted yesterday provide that if you wish to testify on a bill, you remain in the audience for the remainder of the hearing as you're acting as a proponent or opponent and not a committee member at that point. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Vice Chair Welch, would you please open on your bill?
Thank you. Madam Chair Beard, members of the House Taxation Committee, for the record, my name is Representative Tom Welch, last name spelled W-E-L-C-H. I represent Montana House District 72, which is southwest Montana, Beaverhead County, and a portion of Butte Silver Bow County. I'm here this morning to bring to you House Bill 52. This combined bill amends two existing statutes to clarify current practices and to clarify who at Montana State University Bozeman does the annual unit months calculation needed to create $1,500 per year of income for qualified grazing ground. Quite simply, these changes in statute would create clarification and remove filing burdens to the taxpayer. Currently, 15-6-2024C MCA requires taxpayers to have farm implements or construction equipment in a dealership's purchase incentive rental program to report the equipment to the department quarterly. However, the department currently values only property that was placed, that was put in place as of January 1st of each tax year, and is reported to the department no later than March 31st. The quarterly reporting requirement that's now in current statute is not needed to accurately reflect what property that is taxable each year and is a burden to the taxpayer. The next statute that we're seeking to amend and clarify is 15-7-2023 MCA. This statute sets the requirements for qualifying agricultural land. Currently, the statute sets the requirements for grazing ground qualification and requires that a calculation be made to set the minimum number of animal unit months needed to produce $1,500 a year of income on a given parcel of land. This statute further requires that this calculation is made by Montana State University Bozeman College of Agricultural Economics and Economics. Since the statute was enacted, there have been organizational changes within the college itself. Due to these changes, it's no longer the College of Agricultural Economics and Economics that does the calculations. We're just correcting that name. To avoid confusion, this bill recommends referencing only Montana State University Bozeman College of Agriculture and strikes a reference to agricultural economics and economics. So basically, the bill just makes two simple changes. It does nothing else. And I'll have you take a look at that, and I will stand for questions after we hear proponents and opponents.
Thank you, Representative. Now we're going to hear our virtual testimony, proponents first and then opponents. And if you are on the Zoom link as a registered proponent, would you please raise your hands now? We are going to alternate between those here in person and those on Zoom. And first of all, I'd like to see if we have any testimony from outside the room in the hallway. If we have anyone here in person to testify, please enter the chamber, the room. Seeing none. Ms. Murphy, who's first in the queue on Zoom?
Good morning, Madam Chair. First, we have Bryce Katz.
Mr. Katz, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bryce Katz, that's K-A-A-T-Z. I'm a program support unit manager with the Department of Revenue's Property Assessment Division. First, we would just like to thank Representative Welch for carrying this bill on behalf of the department. He did a pretty good job of laying out what it does. It's really just a simplification and cleanup bill, changing that annual reporting requirement that's currently to be reported to us quarterly for those items in the rental purchase incentive agreements. To just March 31st, this better aligns with the annual filing requirement for personal property, which is March 1st. That's really the only time we need to know that information for valuation purposes. Having someone report it the other quarters of the year is really does no good. We don't use that information for anything. So that's just a simplification on that portion. And then the second part of the bill, again, is just a cleanup. As Representative Welch explained, there's been some reorganization within the Department of Ag at MSU as far as which department does this AUM calculation for us. This is just broadening that out to just say the Department of Agriculture and not mention a specific department within that college in case they go through a reorganization again in the future. We don't have to come back to you again asking for you to make that change. This just broadens that to be exclusive to the College of Agriculture at MSU. With that, I will be available for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Katz. Ms. Hamilton, or sorry, Ms. Murphy, do we have anyone else in the queue?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. May I have one of our staffers, or if you prefer myself, to acknowledge what testimony we should be able to reference that was submitted? Ms. Moore, may I go ahead and list out the number of testimonies that we've received, if there are any?
Madam Chair, you're asking about whether there was written testimony submitted online, is that correct?
That is correct.
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure how that's handled.
Thank you. I'll just go ahead and enter for the record that we did indeed receive confirmation of support of as being a proponent from Bryce Kotz, and we also received an electronic position as a proponent from Bob Story with the Montana Taxpayers Association. Any further proponents? Seeing none, we will move on to opponents. Ms. Murphy, do we have any proponents with their hands raised in the queue?
Madam Chair, we have no opponents with hands raised.
Thank you. And having a report that there are no opponents in the hallway, I would like to just acknowledge that we've heard from the witnesses, and I would like to invite Vice Chair Welch to close on his bill. Questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Vice Chair Welch, we have to open the committee to questions from the members. Question. Representative Brewster.
Madam Chair, Representative Welch.
Volume.
Not turned on.
All right. Madam Chair, Representative Welch, when you guys referenced line 22 about where you deleted the part of Department of Agriculture, Economics, and Economics College of Agriculture, both you and the other gentleman who testified said that it was should be simply University of Bozeman College of Agriculture, but it's listed as just University of Bozeman. Is just University of Montana State University Bozeman what you wanted to list without anything after it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, just to prevent having to go through this. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Brewster, in response to your question, yeah, we just want to simplify so we don't have to go through this again if there's another reorganization. The departments had to make some adjustments because of the name change that's been made over time. And actually, if you want to get into the weeds on the matter, they've had to have an attorney draw up a memorandum of understanding every 2 years saying that it's the same entity. Well, why? I mean, we can clarify it with this name change. So that's what we're trying to do there. Just clarify, and then should something happen going forward, it's still Montana State University, Bozeman.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Welch. And at this moment, I want to acknowledge that I overlooked calling for informational witnesses. So at this moment, I'd like to just check quickly to see if we have any. There are none in the hallway. Ms. Murphy, do we have any online?
No, there are none online, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Please continue with questioning. Representative Malone.
Madam Chair, I have a question for the sponsor.
Representative Welch.
Chairman Beard, Representative Malone.
Representative Welch, why are we not using a state department like DNRC, which sets grazing rights for land board? And it's in state statute how they set it.
The current statute for this is cited in the bill, so this has been done this way for a long, long time, and why it isn't changed, I have no idea. I mean, I'm not. We can ask, refer to the department. They may be able to address that. But we're not making a change to the way that it's been done, and I understand your question is, why is this different than maybe something else? And I can't answer that. I can tell you that this is the way that it has been. We're not making a change to that at this point, and maybe there's a clarification or something that can be done there. So I would refer that to the department if I can, Madam Chair.
Please, yes, referred to the department. Can we get a response from the department? Do we have Mr. Kotz still on?
Yes, Madam Chair, just 1 second, please.
Thank you.
Uh, Madam Chair, Representative Malone, I guess similar to Representative Welch, I guess I can't speak to the legislative intent as to why the rental rate that you're speaking about for that calculation and why this calculation on what we use for determining qualification for receiving ag status for assessment purposes is. We can definitely do some research on that, but as Representative Welch kind of explained, these are really two different things. This calculation that we're specifically referencing is just determining minimum AUM for qualifying to receive ag status and classification for appraisal purposes, and is completely separate from the calculation that is used for determining the rental rate on for leases on state land.
Can I have a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Kotz. Follow-up?
Are we calculating the dollar per Representative Welch, excuse me. Are we calculating the dollar of AUMs or the number of AUMs that a piece of land can carry?
Again, I'll let the department answer. I've got a note here, but I'm going to have the department, since they're the expert in that, answer.
Mr. Kotz, it's to you. Mr. Kotz?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. This calculation specifically is the minimum AUM calculation that needs to be met in order to qualify to receive agricultural classification on grazing land. So it's not specific to a rate itself. It's the minimum AUM calculation needed to meet the $1,500 income requirement to receive ag status on grazing land.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Kearns.
Can I ask a question to Representative Welch?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I had a question as to why Montana State University is not capitalized as to proper name, and also College of Agriculture. If we are changing the name, and that is a proper name of a school, even though I am going to the University of Montana, I would think that that would be something we could capitalize.
Thank you,
Representative Chair Beard, Representative Kearns. I wondered the same thing. I'm not the bill drafter or writer. You know, it goes through legal review. But if you look the way it was, as you read a bill, so that anything that is crossed out is coming out. Anything that is underlined is being added. As you look through this bill, it's very simple. I mean, there are not many things being taken out or anything in the weeds being added. It's pretty straightforward. But if you look, that was Montana State University, and State University was lowercase in the existing bill, existing statute, and it's staying that way. And I'm not the drafter, and I'm not the why that is. It's been that way, and they're leaving it that way, I guess, is the best answer I have.
Thank you, Representative Welch. Ms. Moore, did you want to just put a point on that?
Sure, Madam Chair. Representative Kearns, our bill drafting style provides that we capitalize very few things. Montana is one of the things we capitalize, as well as city names, but we do not capitalize, for example, university names, department names, and things of that nature.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. Any further questions at this time from committee members? Seeing none. Vice Chair Welch, would you like to close on House Bill 52?
Yes, I would. Members, Madam Chair and members of the committee, as I said, basically a very simple, straightforward bill trying to clean up two things. There may be more issues out there, but we're not attempting to address anything in this bill but two minor things that would just make, number one, allows the people to only have to report once a year because we're only using the number once a year. So, you know, it helps our ag people out there not having to do meaningless reports. So we clean that up. And the other thing we do is just clarify the name so the department does not have to work through a memorandum of understanding to clarify the name. And this prevents them from having to do that going forward should there be another name change or department change or something along those lines. So simply a straightforward cleanup bill. Nothing in the weeds here, straightforward. So I would ask for a due pass when it comes time for consideration. And I want to thank you for a good hearing on House Bill 52.
Thank you, Representative. This closes the hearing on House Bill 52. Now, I want to confirm with staff that we are ready to hear the next bill via virtual format. House Bill 17 being introduced by Representative Hamilton. Representative Hamilton, when you're ready, would you please open on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may be the first virtual bill or virtual presentation that's happening, and so certainly for you and for me as well, if we run into any technical difficulties, please let me know quickly. So I'm Jim Hamilton, representative for House District 61. That's the east side of Bozeman out to the Park County line. Bring to you today House Bill 17, the Alternative Energy System Credit. The bill is being brought to you at request for the Revenue Interim Committee. The Revenue Interim Committee was tasked to review credits in the next several interims. They're not required to state whether that credit should be continued or not, but it just to review it. And with this particular credit, a point was made to continue it, and then this bill was brought forward to improve the credit. Credit was started in 1977, became permanent in 2002, and so it has a long history of being part of our tax system. Sorry. So let me start with two basic facts. Number one, the alternative energy systems definition. There's another credit that you may see referenced at various times called the Energy Conservation System Credit. Energy Conservation Credit, think of it this way, is about saving energy. The alternative energy system is about generating energy. So that's how you would distinguish between the two. This one is on the generation side. So this credit is also at present a regular tax credit. You get a credit of up to $500 against your taxes. But what we're proposing in this bill is to make it a refundable credit. The difference between a regular credit and a refundable credit is that a refundable credit, you receive the money for that credit even if you do not have a tax liability. The simplest definition there. So the credit at this point is equal to the cost of the system as well as installation costs, but it can't exceed more than a $500 tax credit per taxpayer. But of course, per couple, it would be $1,000. So the credit for an energy system using a recognized non-fossil form of energy generation is what's actually in the code about this. And any credit that you receive must be reduced, the value of the system must be reduced by the amount of any grants received. At present, once again, the bill is non-refundable, or the credit is non-refundable, but it may be carried forward for four tax years. So I think there's three major benefits to passing this bill. One, it diversifies the energy portfolio while allowing your constituents to save money. Secondly, it generates more business in your local communities. This credit not only goes to the homeowner, but of course that means the homeowner invested money in a system which employed a multiplicity of workers to get that going. And third, it's a matter of equity among taxpayers. Making this credit refundable makes it more accessible to those with lower or middle income who have little tax liability but have made significant investment in their system, or as we like to say around the Capitol, it's a lot of skin in the game. So Megan, Ms. Moore, did during the interim create a wonderful brochure that I would draw your attention to, a very thorough history of the credit, talks about the changes that have occurred, the usage of it, and I don't know that I can even share my screen, but even if I could, that might confuse matters even more. So I will tell you, the way to get there is go to laws, on to committees, on to interim, look at committee interim for the revenue committee, look at committee topics, and the alternate energy credit is there. Wonderful brochure, lots of information. So before I sit down and let the proponents speak about this, I just want to say we decided in the Revenue Interim Committee to keep this credit. It was a definitive decision, unlike some of the other credits where we made no recommendation whether it would be kept or discarded. Since the committee has decided to keep it, I think we need to improve it and encourage more folks to invest in energy that will save them some money. With that, Madam Chair, I'll sit down and allow proponents and opponents to speak and come back when they're done.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. We are going to be taking hearing from proponents at this time, and we will start with the proponents that are outside the door ready to come in. I believe we have one. Yes, sir. Would you please introduce yourself, spell your last name, and indicate to whom you are representing?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ruben Castren. For the record, that is C-A-S-T-R-E-N. I'm here today representing the Montana Public Interest Research Group. Montperg stands in support of House Bill 17 because we'll make the already existing alternative energy systems tax credit more fair and accessible to all taxpayers. This tax incentive already exists, but because it is only a credit and not a refund, it is only available to those who have a high enough tax liability to claim it. Therefore, low-income, often younger taxpayers, are excluded. We believe that all Montanans should have access to this tax incentive, and therefore encourage you all to support House Bill 17. Thank you, and I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Castren. I want to just check, do we have any more individuals in the hallway for proponents? Seeing none, we are going to turn it over to those signed in on Zoom. Ms. Murphy, how many do we have with their hands raised at this time?
With hands raised at this time, we have five, Madam Chair.
All right, let's go ahead and hear an introduction from the first one.
First, we have Joan Kay.
Ms. Kay, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. My name is Joan Kresich, K-R-E-S-I-C-H. I reside at 410 South 6th Street in Livingston. I am co-chair of Yellowstone Bend Citizens Council, which is an affiliate of Northern Plains Resource Council. I'm speaking in favor of HB 17. A strong majority of Montanans are in favor of a shift to clean energy. The benefits of this transition are enormous. We reap savings that keep wealth in our communities. We own, we control our energy. We avoid costly blackouts. Living in a small town is a perfect way to understand that we thrive together or we don't thrive. In the words of Robin Wall Kimmerer, all flourishing is mutual. In our current economy, there are very few ways to save money. For a household or a small business, saving energy is one of those very few ways to belt tighten. And in these times, we're all needing to belt tighten. This bill would revise the state alternative energy tax credit to be refunded if the amount exceeds the tax liability requirements of the individual. This is a change that would make going solar even more financially compelling, especially for individuals who may fall in a lower income tax bracket. So for our families, our small businesses, our communities, I hope you will support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kresich. The next proponent, please.
Next, we have Tyler Mortensen.
Thank you. Mr. Mortensen.
Hello, can you all hear me?
Yes.
All right, perfect. Thank you, Chair Beard and members of the committee. My name is Tyler Mortensen. That's Mortenson. And I'm a member of the Northern Plains Resource Council from Billings, Montana, testifying in support of HB 17. So I'm an architect here in Billings and also a homeowner. I just recently bought my first house here a little over a year ago. And in the near future, I would like to install some electrical generation on my house. And I, because I really value energy independence and being able to choose electricity or where my electricity comes from, and there really aren't a lot of options for that here currently. And so because of that, I would like to use this tax credit, and I think that it is a valuable tool for me and others in similar situations to be able to install generation. I also think it's valuable because of the job creation. As an architect here in Billings, I've seen that the solar industry and the wind industry are really rising industries in this area. And I think helping them kind of gain a foothold and opening them up to more people would really benefit our economy. Because of all of that, I think this bill is a great idea. I think it's going, or making the tax credit fully refundable will improve the tax credit. I think it simplifies it and just makes it easier for people to be able to use. And by doing that, it makes it easier to install these systems and really maximize the benefits of those systems going forward. That's all I had. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mortensen. Next proponent, please.
Yes, Madam Chair. Next we have Andrew Villanis.
Andrew, please go ahead and pronounce your last name again for us.
Good morning, Chair Beard and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Villanis. My last name is spelled V-A-L-A-I-M-I-S, zooming in from Missoula, Montana. I'm the executive director of the Montana Renewable Energy Association, and for those who I haven't worked with yet on the committee, MREA is a statewide membership-based association of renewable energy supporters, advocates, and businesses. Our membership includes those businesses that install rooftop solar, small wind, geothermal, microhydro, and other renewable energy technologies, but we also represent Montanans from across the state who simply support and or own distributed generation systems. And we're asking the committee to support this bill. I submitted comments ahead of this meeting that have a little more detail for you, but I just wanted to highlight some of those points this morning. This is really a simple bill. It creates fairness and it creates opportunities for more Montanans to save money. The cost of solar and wind systems have really dropped significantly over the past decade, and with that, they're offering long-term savings, energy savings for more and more Montanans. But the upfront costs to achieve those savings can still be challenging for particularly lower and moderate income Montanans, which is where the customer base is trending for the industry right now. And MREA estimates that in 2019 alone, Montanans across the state who own solar and wind systems saved approximately $1.8 million in energy costs by owning these systems. So we feel by allowing this credit to be refundable, it's going to allow lower and moderate income Montanans to really participate in those savings, which we think is a great thing. And as was mentioned by the sponsor, the benefits really go beyond the household claiming it, because it's supporting investments that benefit local industries and local economies. The small businesses installing solar and wind systems average less than 10 employees, and they're really located all across the state. And by necessity, these businesses actually require engaging and hiring other contractors and industries. So electricians are required to tie the system to the grid safely, and state inspectors are required to certify the system, plus other construction jobs that help with support structures and the design. In 2019 alone, MREA estimated that this credit helped fuel $11.2 million in revenue for the businesses working in the installation. And then finally, I just want to highlight that the financial impact of this credit is actually offset both by the investment in the local businesses that I just mentioned, but also by the fees paid to cities and counties. Again, by necessity, solar and wind systems require fees that must be paid, including electrical permits, building permits, plan review by city and county staff. And that can actually account for up to almost half of what the average credit claimed each year is. So a lot of that just gets paid right back. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I will again point you to our written comments for additional details. We ask you to support House Bill 17, and I am available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Villanis. I did want to remind people that when you do submit your testimony in writing, please have additional information or summarized information for your oral testimony, because we all do have copies of your written testimony. Ms. Murphy, who's next, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. Next, we have Connor Ploger.
Thank you. Mr. Ploger.
Hello. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Good morning, Madam Chair Beard and other members of the committee. My name is Connor Ploger. That's spelled P as in Paul, L-O-E-G-E-R. And I am here as the Clean Energy Program Director for the Montana Environmental Information Center, or MEIC. And I am here on behalf of the organization to support House Bill 17, introduced by Representative Hamilton. A lot of the proponents have addressed a lot of the points that MEIC was going to address, so I won't reiterate anything that hasn't already been stated. However, I would like to state that, in short, this measure has been incredibly successful, and therefore we want to ensure its longevity and ensure that it becomes a more successful program by making it more appealing to more individuals. What we have seen through the economic benefits is that this has benefited small businesses. Sales generated approximately $7.2 million in revenue for small businesses, but also we would like to highlight the larger economic benefits as well. That includes construction, electricians, plumbing, etc. So this will just benefit the larger economy and therefore could only help Montana at large. But also we would like to reiterate some of the points made regarding the tax liability. By making this more fair and allowing lower income people to participate in this program and making it more appealing for lower income people, that just means that more and more people are going to participate in this program, which therefore helps the small business economy me even more so, but also helps lower income people that may be struggling after the pandemic and may need some extra assistance, but may also want to participate in renewable energy programs. So for those two reasons, MEIC is strongly in favor of this bill. We would also like to highlight some of the figures. Andrew from MREA pointed out some of how some of the figures that benefit Montanans. We'd also like to point out the Revenue Interim Committee's report that Representative Hamilton addressed. In 2018, 912 taxpayers claimed $500,000 in credits. So therefore, if we're just making this more appealing for more and more Montanans, that number will only increase, which will only increase revenue within the state, which only makes it more beneficial. And as MREA pointed out, this has little impact to the state at large. The state can afford to pay this, but also will have a minimum impact to the general fund as well, as well as what Andrew pointed out, the benefits the cities will receive from permits, etc. I am ready for any questions if you guys have, or if the members have them, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Mr. Ploger, thank you for being here. Next proponent, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Marler has her hand raised.
Do we want to hold that for questions from committee members, or Representative Marler, are you a proponent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a procedural question.
Go ahead, Representative.
I was wondering if you or staff could clarify when members of the public provide their comment ahead of time, if they're testifying remotely, where does that go and how do we access that?
Ms. Moore, you're on.
Madam Chair, Representative Marler, we're working the kinks out in the process. There will be a process by which it's emailed to committee members. I'm not sure we got that done for today, but we will certainly follow up and get those statements sent out to the committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Thank you so much, Representative Marler. I see Representative Dunwell also has a procedural question.
Yes, Madam Chair, good morning and thank you. Just to piggy, because I was wondering the same thing, trying to find on the internet where the testimony would be and the documents. Would it be possible to post these on the web, possibly along with where the bill itself is posted, something like that, just in case it would get lost in our emails, which we get a lot of, as you know. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dunwell. Ms. Moore, would you just put a finished piece of icing on that question?
Madam Chair, Representative Dunwell, I think we're exploring the possibility of making a Teams channel for the committee where we would post all the documents because we are concerned about the email. And I will keep the committee updated on how we plan to proceed with getting the testimony to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick follow-up.
One more follow-up and let's get on with proponents, please.
Then I'm done for the day. The public, however, may also want to access these documents. So it would be a repository for the public and other lobbyists as well as legislators. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Dunwell, the testimony provided will be included in the minutes which are available to the public online.
Perfect. Thank you. Further proponents, please, Ms. Murphy.
Yes, Madam Chair. Next, we have Nicola Laverick.
Mr. Laverick, go ahead, please. Mr. Laverick, you need to unmute, please.
Chair Beard and members of the committee, sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Yes, Ms. Laverick. Go ahead, please.
My name is Nicola Laverack. It's L-A-V as in Victor, E-R-A-C-K. I live in Stevensville, and I work as the communications director for OnSite Energy, a solar electric design build company that serves the entire state with offices in Bozeman and Missoula. One of our core beliefs as a company is that solar energy should be accessible to all Montanans, which is why I'm here today to ask for your support of House Bill 17. From remote off-grid cabins, downtown homes, rural homes big and small, we serve all kinds of customers with varying budgets and energy goals. While the Alternative Energy System Tax Credit is an important incentive to make solar energy more affordable, it can also be exclusionary to households that need it the most. By making the tax credit refundable, this bill would create equitable access to energy and financial savings for all households, regardless of their tax liabilities. Making this tax credit available to every household in a way that is indiscriminate of income levels and tax liability would be taking one step closer to our central driving goal of being able to provide access to energy independence for all Montanans. For example, another example, there's a few been given today, but a consistent portion of our residential customer base is folks who are retired and on a fixed income, very budget conscious, and often with very low tax liability for those reasons. House Bill 17 would have a significant positive impact on those types of households that rely on prudent long-term financial planning by increasing access to reduced monthly energy bills and protection from future utility rate increases. Small changes like those outlined in House Bill 17, can create local economic benefits felt far and wide. In addition to helping households with limited incomes access financial energy savings, House Bill 17 would support small local companies like ours by creating more jobs for our team. And as has been mentioned, we do not work alone. Each project includes a combination of local subcontracted architects, engineers, electricians, roofers, excavators, and the local jurisdiction fees for permitting and plan review. For these reasons, I hope you will make your vote in support of House Bill 17. And thank you for your time, and sorry for my mute confusion.
Thank you, Ms. Laverick. Sorry for my confusion early up. I did notice that you had also submitted this testimony in written form. However, it obviously isn't quite available to the public. So thank you for reading that to us, and thank you for being here. Ms. Murphy, who's next, please?
Madam Chair, we don't have anyone with a raised hand, but I do want to remind those out there that if you would like to speak, to please raise your hand. And if you're on the phone, you can press star 9 to do so.
Thank you. Any activity?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. It seems that we have no further proponents, so at this time, we'd like to listen to opponents. So do we have any opponents out in the hall area? Any opponents here in person? Seeing none. Do we have opponents online?
No, Madam Chair.
Seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Murphy. Informational witnesses. Do we have any informational witnesses? Seeing none, we'd like to go now to committee members for questions. Do we have any questions? Representative Knudsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the sponsor, please.
Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair, Representative Knudsen.
You're going to need to lean into your microphone just a bit more, Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair, Representative Knudsen.
Representative Knudsen.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, do you have an estimated cost of this proposed tax refund? And is there a second question, same question, is there a fiscal note to follow?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would assume there is a fiscal note to follow. I think that is the chair's discretion to ask for it. Very difficult at this point to identify what kind of uptake there would be. What we can see is when we've looked at changes in this credit in previous times, you would expect something like a 15 to 20% increase might be a reasonable guess, and bearing in mind it is a guess.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Vice Chair Fern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for the sponsor.
Representative Fern.
Representative Hamilton, this committee last session actually put forward this bill for the interim to evaluate the tax credit. So I know it's of interest to a lot of us who have been here to see how this process has worked. In your discussions and the evaluation of this credit, did you look at or did you think about the idea of whether the 912 people who used this last tax season, would they have continued to seek the energy program, whether there was a tax credit or not? Or in other words, in simple terms, is the tax credit necessary to have the type of business and interest that is occurring with installation of small renewable energy projects?
Madam Chair, Representative Fern, the answer to that question is it's very difficult to determine prospective behavior. And so I can't say that we have an answer to that. However, I would refer once again to the great brochure that Ms. Moore drew up. Whenever there in the past has been a change in this credit, there has been a fairly significant uptake in the use of the credit, which tells me it is effective in motivating behavior.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Dunwell, we see you on Zoom. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a question, please, Madam Chair, for Mr. Valenis.
Mr. Valenis?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dunwell.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Valenis. Given, we're facing an interesting budget time for the general fund. Can you drill down more about the fiscal advantage to local investments and local governments and local communities with this?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dunwell. As I mentioned during our testimony, I think one of the benefits that we see of a tax credit like this supporting some of the local businesses is that it's wide ranging. So, we looked at, I think the average credit claimed in 2019 was $700 or approximately $700 per individual who claimed it. And I mean, we're showing almost up to $300 paid right back in the fees, which, like I said, is about, 40 to 50% of the credit that goes right back into cities and counties. So it's kind of cycling, from the state, but filtering back into city and county budgets. Now that doesn't include, inspections, state inspectors who come to certify the system, which again is required. And that doesn't touch on the other benefit that we mentioned to the local businesses. As I put in the testimony, we looked at 2019, although we've looked at other years as well. And in 2019 alone, we saw $11.2 million in revenue. And these businesses really are local. I don't think we have any, I'm pretty positive we don't have any national installation groups working in the state. These are all small businesses and they're growing, but, they want to hire more staff and feel like, they're trying to do that. So I think with more investment in these systems, we're going to see more local jobs who are hired. People like the other proponent that spoke from Onsite Energy, more local jobs located all across the state. So we're seeing that filter down through all sorts of different industries.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Belanis. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Representative Kearns.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, can I ask him a question?
Representative Hamilton.
So as a hypothetical, Madam Chair.
Through the chair, please.
Madam Chair, as a hypothetical, let me just kind of understand this. So if I were to put a $100 solar panel on my house and I did not pay any state income taxes, then I would be able to claim $500 coming back from the state for that. Is that how I understand this tax credit?
Madam Chair, Representative, no. The amount of the credit is limited to the cost of the installation. So if you put a $100 panel on your roof, your maximum credit for you would be $100.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Fielder.
Madam Chair, I have a question for the sponsor.
Representative Hamilton.
Representative Fielder.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, right now, as I understand it, this tax credit is a credit which would be applicable for the tax year and up to 4 years afterwards. And if we change this to an immediate refund of the expenses, could that be an unlimited refund of expenses? We're talking about an unlimited amount of money right now, I believe. If we heard the example of putting a $100 panel on there and being reimbursed $100. If you put $100,000 worth of panels on your facility, that would be an unlimited, or you know, you'd be reimbursed the total $100,000. Right now, it seems to be a limit on there and the amount of money that could be carried over. Can you respond to that question, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Tucker, thank you for the question. No, the answer is that if, regardless whether this credit is carried over for 4 years or it is taken immediately, the maximum credit you could have is $500 per taxpayer, so $1,000 per couple. So in your example of a $100,000 system, you put a $100,000 system in, you get a $500 tax credit.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Welch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the sponsor, please.
Representative Welch.
Representative Hamilton, I'm curious about, and I didn't get a chance to look, about how this bill came out of committee vote-wise, and also comments, if there were people who opposed it, what their concerns were, please.
Representative Welch, the bill, if I remember correctly, and you would probably have to check this to verify, came out of the committee 7-5, 7 in favor, 5 opponents. And probably not really a fair thing for me to do to try to represent the position of the opponents. I think there may be one or two people on the revenue committee who could do that.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Kearns.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton's question. Can I ask him a question?
Certainly. Go ahead.
Representative Kearns.
Madam Chair, just as a clarification again, so if I were to put a $500 solar panel on my property, then the state of Montana would then be paying for my $500 solar panel. Is that correct? Is that how I read that?
Representative, once again, the maximum credit that can be received is $500 or the cost of the system. I'm saying that backwards. Maximum is the cost of the system or $500, whichever is less.
Follow-up?
Follow-up question.
Go ahead, Representative Kearns.
Madam Chair, so again, if I were to spend $500 to buy this solar panel, then I would be reimbursed this $500, and in theory, the state of Montana would be buying my $500 solar panel. Is that correct?
Representative, once again, the limit is a $500 credit, regardless of whatever you spend.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Fern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for Ms. Lavrak, if she's still there. Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Lavrak, Representative Fern.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lavrak, can you give us an idea, and I know asking for averages is rather difficult, but I'm trying to weigh in, trying to consider what $500 or $1,000 really means in the context of a project. Could you talk a little bit about, as close as you can do, to averages of a cost of a project? And maybe you could take, maybe you could look at it per square foot or just take a 2,000 square foot single home, maybe something that you run into a lot, and talk a little bit about what the expense of a project might be.
Sure. I'd say an average residential project in the Bozeman area could be maybe around 5 kilowatts in size. 3 kilowatts would be for a, you know, a home with a low energy demand, and then homes with higher energy demands go up from there. So 5 is a good average, and a recent 5 kilowatt residential project that we sold was before any incentives, just shy of $16,000. So the tax incentives, this tax incentive and the ITC federal tax incentive are crucial for every single job. It's put into the financial analysis in every single proposal that we give.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So you alluded to within the financial package mentioning of the tax credit. Could you talk about prior knowledge of your customer base as far as a tax credit, and more specifically, if that tax credit is sort of even close to a game changer for folks?
I am not in sales, so I'd like to start with I can't speak with huge authority into what the dynamic is like, but I spoke with our head sales guy yesterday, and I'd say it is hugely important and can be, you know, a matter of $1,000 can be the yes or no to whether this pencils out financially for a household, like I mentioned, that's, you know, in retirement on a fixed budget and is making this decision down to the cent. So it is a game changer. It's hugely important, and it doesn't feel good to tell some people that there is this tax credit available in Montana, but not for you.
Thank you, Ms. Labrek. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Sheldon Galloway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have two questions for two different people, so if you want me just to do one and however you want me to do that.
Let's start with number one and see how that goes.
Okay. I have a question for Ms. Laverick from Onsite Energy.
And Ms. Laverick, it's through the chair, please.
Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like you to define for me what a project is. So I'm going to give you an example, and if you could maybe confirm what I'm saying. If I put two panels on my house roof in 2020, would I get is that a project? And then if I added two panels in 2021, is that another project? And let's say within 10 years, I now have 20 panels on my house. How could you define project for me?
Yes, those would all be
through the chair, please.
Madam Chair, sorry. Yes, those would all be projects. It would start as your installation, and then we'd define them as expansions after that if you kept adding to the size of your array. So your original installation project and then future expansion projects.
Thank you. Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to do a conclusion then from what she told me. If I put 20 panels on in 10 years, that would be $5,000 credit given to me. My husband lives in the home also. I could add another $5,000 for him. I would have a $10,000 credit towards my household project on my roof. If I'm wrong, someone can clarify that, but that was the conclusion I just came from. Testimony. Thank you.
Ms. Laverick, would you like to respond or refer that response?
I would like to refer that response to the carrier of the bill. I'm not positive how expansion projects work with the tax incentive. My apologies.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton, would you like to take a stab at that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to refer that to Megan, who knows this even better. Megan, what would you think in this case?
Ms. Moore.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe that an original project would be one project. If you were to expand the number of panels, that would qualify as an additional project. However, if you then needed to replace parts of an original project, those replacements would not qualify for the credit. That's my understanding from the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Ms. Moore.
Representative Mitchell, did you have a question?
A question for the sponsor.
Representative Hamilton.
Representative Mitchell.
I'd like to mention you shied away from Rep. Kearns' question. If you spend $500, will that tax credit be paid out by the state of Montana? And what tax bracket, if any, would an individual need to be in to qualify, or if any?
Madam Chair, Representative Mitchell, I'm not sure I know what the second part of your question was about the tax bracket, because this credit being refundable would be refunded regardless of your tax bracket, or used as an offset against your taxes. As to the first part about Representative Kern's question, it is very clear that if you had a $500 system put on your roof, you would get a $500 credit. And once again, we keep talking about solar panels, but unrealistic, as Ms. Laverick had said, to think about a $500 project. If the average 5-kilowatt project is $16,000, there's going to be very little that you could do in the way of a project that would be anyplace close to $500. There are some possibilities of having that small of a project for a wood stove, for example, which is included in as an alternative energy system. But the high preponderance of these systems are way over $500.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. We have a question from Representative Tribus, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be for either Representative Hamilton or Ms. Moore or whoever wants to tackle it. In the bill, line 16, it strikes the may be carried over, so the carryovers. Is there a way that we'll be able to deal with prior tax years and current carryovers that exist? Can we grandfather those in, or are they just kind of grandfathered in based on the tax law at that time? Of course, keeping them to their current limits at the taxpayer liability for that year. How would that work?
Representative Hamilton?
Madam Chair, Representative Tweebus, I'm going to make a pretty educated guess here, but it is a little bit of a guess, and that is that your ability to carry this over is based on the year in which you actually made the investment, got the credit. And therefore, that would not go away if this piece of the bill, if this bill was revised. You would retain the same $500 credit, and your ability to take that credit would be dependent on what your tax liability is in the succeeding years. So it does not, in my opinion, take that away.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Sheldon Galloway.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to do my second question. I have a question for the bill sponsor.
Representative Hamilton.
Representative Sheldon Galloway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hamilton, you keep referring to $500, and I don't see that in this wording anywhere. And I would like to know where in statute that is, or if we need to add it to this, because I don't see 500 guaranteed anything in here.
Madam Chair, Representative Sheldon Galloway, I'm looking at the bill here, and you're right, that's not in it, because we're not changing the dollar amount of the credit. That will be as it currently exists, so that's not a new feature. And I believe, we'd have to look that up, but I believe it's in the section 1532.202, and we can double check that with Mrs. Moore.
Madam Chair, Representative Sheldon Galloway, it's actually 1532.201 is the section with the credit amount.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. And Ms. Moore, we have one more question. Representative Hinkle.
Madam Chair, I have a question for the sponsor.
Representative Hamilton.
Representative Hinkle.
Madam Chair, Representative. So you mentioned wood stoves are included as alternative energy. I'm just wondering, just in terms of code, what does not qualify as alternative energy? I assume, of course, coal is natural gas in there. Is there anything else that does not qualify as alternative energy, essentially, or this?
Madam Chair, Representative, I am now looking back at the brochure that I referred you to from Ms. Moore, and in that it covers the categories of energy systems that are eligible for credit. So, and the way that it says it is, as I mentioned earlier in my presentation, using a recognized non-fossil form of energy generation or using a low emission wood or biomass combustion device. So anything that doesn't fit that definition would not be available for the credit.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Now the chair reserves the right to ask one final question on this committee. And my question is this applicable to residential only or commercial as well?
Madam Chair, I believe there is no restriction on whether this is used residentially or commercially. Let's double check that with Ms. Moore, though.
Ms. Moore.
Madam Chair, the credit must be claimed by a resident individual taxpayer, and it's for installation in the taxpayer's principal dwelling.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Ms. Moore, and that is once again in that brochure that Ms. Moore made up. So a lot of great information in there.
Thank you very much. Now, Representative Hamilton, would you like to close on House Bill 17?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I want to reference a couple of comments that were made by proponents. I've sat in your chair on Tax Committee, and we sat on the Revenue Committee in the interim. And one of the important elements in evaluating tax credits is a good tax policy is one that's broadly available. That's what this credit does, is it makes a tax credit broadly available, broadens the access to more taxpayers. That's good tax policy. Secondly, it was referred to as creating wealth in our communities. As a former financial advisor, I know a little bit about creating wealth, and wealth comes from a couple of sources. Comes from saving, which your constituents will be able to do with the use of this tax credit. Secondly, it comes from the leverage of that money as that the investment of that money as it goes out in the community and is paid to, contributed to other workers in the community who then pass that on further in the community. So there's some leverage there as well. I don't think we should forget about that when we're talking about this credit and in focusing solely on the homeowner, because this money, as you heard from the testimony from Mr. Alanis, this money gets multiplied many, many times in the community. So there are not only significant benefits to homeowners, but to the local community through fees and permits, as well as the multiplicity of workers that are responsible for installing these kinds of things, electricians, plumbers, installers, construction workers, and architects, and the list goes on and on. So for the three reasons that I gave you earlier, the benefits of passing this bill, one being broadens the access, it's good tax policy. Second being the multiplicity or multiplying of money as it goes out into the community. And the third, giving your constituents an opportunity to save money. For those reasons, I urge you to put a due pass on this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. We'll be considering this bill for executive action during tomorrow's meeting. With that, the hearing on House Bill 17 is concluded. Thank you.
making the switch here. We will now begin the hearing on House Bill 23, and we have sponsored by Representative Becky Beard. And Representative Beard, would you like to open on your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. My name again is Becky Beard. I represent House District 80. It traverses substantial parts of both Powell and Lewis and Clark counties. I'm here today to introduce House Bill 23. And this is some pretty simple language to revise the tax lien and tax deed process at the request of the Revenue Interim Committee. This bill strengthens Senate Bill 253 from the last session. It passed the House on a vote of 89-8. I think that this bill just tightens up a little bit more language in the favor of county treasurers trying to be good public stewards and servants to their county residents. This bill clarifies timeframes, publication notices, accrual of interests and costs, and obligations. County treasurers are there to serve their population base. They are not to act as bankers or attorneys. I understand that there are a few people here with additional information. There will be some proponents, hopefully no opponents, but I would like to reserve the right to close after hearing from these citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Beard. We'll now take testimony from proponents, and I don't believe we have any out in the hallway. I don't know how many we have online. I think all we have outside may be one opponent, so we'll get to that.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and spell your last name for us, if you would, please.
Okay. My name is Terry Kunz. It's K-U-N-Z. And I have the great pleasure of serving Jefferson County as their treasurer a little over 6 years. I also serve with the Montana County Treasurers Association as their treasurer and on the legislative board. I want to thank our bill sponsor, Madam Chair Beard, and the members of the Revenue Interim Committee for their time and effort over the last several months in working with us on SB 223 that is before you this morning, HB. I'm sorry, I can't keep track of this H's and S's. I apologize. So I am here on behalf of all of the 56 county treasurers across the state. And I realize that I am not an expert on the entire process of moving bills through, so I ask your patience while I take you back to 2019 session, where SB 253 bill was first introduced by Senator Smith. The county treasurers worked diligently with this bill to find what all of us believed was the right thing to do for owner-occupied properties going to tax deed. The tax lien to tax deed process is not always easy, so let me give you just a short overview. Each year in June, the current year taxes that are delinquent are sent a notice by the county treasurers just to remind you, you probably forgot to pay your taxes, please do so. After that, they have 60 days to get those payments to us. At the beginning of August, after those 60 days after those notices are sent out, a tax lien certificate is attached by the county treasurer. Once the tax lien certificate is attached, taxpayers have 3 years from the date of the attachment, so it's usually around August 3rd, August 4th, to redeem the tax lien before a tax deed can be considered for issuance. At this point, if the taxpayer does not redeem the tax lien, the county has three options to clear up the delinquent taxes. Tax lien assignments, this is the only option where delinquent taxes are paid and dispersed to the taxing jurisdictions. State statute allows individuals, we call them assignees, to notice the taxpayer 2 weeks prior by certified mail of their intention to purchase the tax lien that the county has filed. Once the 2 weeks has passed, the county treasurer is allowed to issue an assignment certificate to the assignee. The delinquent taxes are paid by the assignee and then marked as an assignment on the county treasurer's records. The owner is then notified by the county treasurer that an assignment has been taken on their property and told of how they can redeem this assignment. Property owners are reminded of this assignment on every tax bill that goes out after the assignment is taken. So on the tax bill, it has a big section that says, please be aware, you have an assignment, your taxes were, so it's a little paragraph. Tax deed action requires notification and publication by the assignee to all interested parties, including lien holders, that a tax deed will be issued. If the assignment is not redeemed by the redemption date, they could lose their property. This process that is in place is beneficial to taxing jurisdictions for clearing up delinquent taxes, whether it is by the owner or the assignee. We believe, the treasurers believe, that SB 253 could work with the amendments that are currently in front of you, that we have presented. I understand there are some who want to flip this bill on its head. We do not wish to do that. We are simply asking your support on this bill as introduced to make the changes that are needed to make it more efficient for treasurers to manage the bill, to get the job done correctly. The county treasurers are attempting to make the bill amendable for working within its parameters. The proposed changes simply, so to speak, streamline the bill so that we can hopefully avoid disputes between owners, occupants, and assignees. We have tried to address changes that directly affect how we manage the bill. I'm going to let Betty Romo, who is on your list today to speak via Zoom, point out the issues that we're trying to clean up. I appreciate all of your time and the people that you represent. The Montana County Treasurer Association would greatly appreciate it if this committee would support HB 23 as it is currently introduced. In addition, please know that every treasurer from wherever you're from is willing to talk to you about this. They are willing to help you understand the tax deed process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Kuntz. Do we have more proponents out there? Okay, no further proponents out there. Ms. Murphy, do we have online proponents?
Mr. Chair, nobody has their hand raised at the moment. Oh, sorry, Betty Romo.
Okay, Ms. Romo.
Good morning.
Through the chair, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Betty Romo, R-O-M-O, and I'm here representing the 56 county treasurers of the Montana County Treasurers Association. I have been the treasurer of Roosevelt County for the past 20 years and the chairperson of the Montana County Treasurers Association Education Committee for the past 5 years. I would like to thank our sponsor, Madam Chair Beard, and the members of the Revenue Interim Committee for their time and effort over the past several months in working with us on House Bill 23 that is before you this morning. The Montana County Treasurers Association has worked very hard alongside the Revenue Interim Committee to make this bill amenable, and we have made great strides from the original language of Senate Bill 253 introduced in the 2019 legislative session. The original intent of Senate Bill 253 was to make sure that the homeowner was not totally displaced from their home because of the tax lien assignment process and left with nothing. We consider House Bill 23 to be a cleanup bill to Senate Bill 253. I understand that there may be significant amendments being brought forward, but we are here today asking for your support on House Bill 23 as introduced. I would like to take a few minutes now to walk you through the highlights of the bill. The first section is 15-18-219, application for tax deed for residential property fee and notice. This statute addresses tax lien assignments that contain a dwelling on residential agricultural, and forest property to go to auction. MCTA's concern here is unintended consequences of an occupant losing their home, but the surplus funds are distributed to the owner of the property. Examples of this include owners who abandon the property, or they sell the property but never issue a deed to the purchaser, rental property, divorce decrees, and deaths. MCTA proposed change is that we have added the language that is currently occupied by the legal title holder of record. This would ensure that the surplus funds are issued to the owner and occupant of the property if it were to go to auction. County treasurers would not be in the middle of a dispute between an owner of the property and the occupant of the dwelling. The next section is 1518.220, sale at public auction, notice of auction. This section provides for the county treasurers to notice and hold an auction before a tax deed can be issued. The opening bid for the auction would be 50% of the market or appraised value. Once the auction has concluded, the high bidder has 24 hours to make payment. If payment is not made, then all bids are canceled and the county treasurer is to notice the notice with 30 days of non-payment within 30 days of non-payment and hold another auction within 30 days of the notice. Our concern is that treasurers could possibly be noticing and holding several auctions for the same piece of property. Our proposed change added auction costs to be paid at the time of sale along with the bid price. Also, if the assignee is the high bidder and neglects to make payment within 24 hours of the county treasurer, 24 hours, the county treasurer shall cancel the assignment and the assignee is out their money. If the high bidder is not the assignee and they neglect to make payment in the time frame allowed, then the high bid is canceled and the next bidder is allowed to purchase the tax deed and so on. If all the bidders do not make the payment, then the assignment shall be canceled. The outcome is that the county treasurers are only having to publish the notice in the newspaper and conduct one auction. If the assignee or the high bidders neglect to make the payment, the end result would be to cancel the assignment. Once canceled, the property would remain in the original owner's name with the taxes being marked as paid. The third section, section 1518.221, distribution of tax deed auction proceeds. This section provides for the distribution of surplus funds to interested parties that submit a claim to the county treasurer within 30 days of the auction. The claim must include the particulars of the lien and the amount currently due. The county treasurer is determining between senior mortgages and liens and junior mortgages and liens. Within 90 days after the claim period expires, the county treasurer makes the determination of the priority of claims and disperses the surplus funds accordingly. Our concern is that the county treasurers are not loan officers or bankers, and as such should not be determining the importance of one lien over another. Our proposed language that now states within 30 days of receiving payment from the purchaser of the tax deed, the county treasurer shall distribute the surplus funds to the legal title holder of record. The outcome of this is that the county is not holding on to the funds for an extended period of time, and the partial equity is dispersed to the legal owner of the property. Thank you so much for all of your time this morning. The Montana Susquehanna County Treasurers Association would greatly appreciate it if the committee would support House Bill 23 as introduced. In addition to myself, any county treasurer would be more than happy to discuss the bill and our concerns in more detail. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Romo. Further proponents out in the hallway? Seeing none, Ms. Murphy online?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have Eric Brayson.
Mr. Chairman, may I go?
Yes, Mr. Brayson, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'll be brief. I think the sponsor, Representative Beard, did a great job talking about kind of the 10,000-foot level, how this bill came about. And I, too, want to thank the Revenue Interim Committee for giving the time and the patience to discuss the concerns that the treasurers had as a result of Senate Bill 253 from last session. And this is a great, I think, collaborative response from the Interim Committee and the treasurers across Montana trying to find ways to clarify and fix the process that was implemented with the changes in SB 253. Of note, as Representative Beard talked about, this does improve and provides additional notice and clarification for time frames. Notice, costs, and obligations. Those are the four things that the treasurers were mostly concerned about with the changes that were fairly sweeping in Senate Bill 253. You heard the details from the two treasurers that provided testimony. If you have questions specifically about the details of the tax deed process, it is complicated, and it is driven by time frames, and it is driven by obligations that the county has in ensuring that nobody, for any reason outside of essentially acknowledgement of will, loses their property by tax deed. These folks do an amazing job to make sure that tax collections can happen and that the processes are followed, and that at the end of the day, nobody, as was heard in testimony previously, accidentally loses their house because of their inability to pay. That was never the intent of the old law. That was never the intent of SB 253, and it's surely not the intent of these changes that are being proposed. I'd finish by saying, again, thank you to the Revenue Interim Committee, and especially thank you to the treasurers who had, for literally 2 years, been discussing reasonable changes to this set of statutes to make sure that the public's protected and that the process is enhanced. And I think that's what you see before you. So I do encourage your fair consideration of this bill, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brayson. Further online proponents?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Do we have opponents? I'm sorry, Representative Knutson.
Chair Welch, I did not hear Mr. Bryson's introduction as to his name and what group he might be representing.
Great point. Oversight by the acting chair. Mr. Bryson, would you please state your who you were representing, who you work with, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that was not your fault, Mr. Chairman. That was my fault. Eric Bryson, B as in boy, R-Y-S-O-N, and I am here on behalf of the Montana Association of Counties, and my sincere apologies.
Thank you, Representative. Great catch. Okay, opponents, I believe we have one. I'm sorry, did I skip? Did we have more, just 1 second, do we have more online proponents?
No, Mr. Chair, no more online proponents.
Okay. Was there, okay. We will go to in-person opponents. Please identify yourself. Spell your last name for us, if you would, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives on the committee. My name is William Gowen, G-O-W-E-N. And I am with the Montana Land Title Association, a past president and a member of our legislative committee for many, many years. It's nice to be back in tax committee. I am going to rise as a very light opponent of this legislation. I opposed the last one, Senate Bill 253, because we thought we had a bill that worked before that, the session before. It didn't get a chance to work. But that being said, it was passed, and there's some cleanup that needs to be done. I think that most of this is really good. We're just the people that end up at the very end. We do the litigation guarantee, which identifies the lien holders, owners, and notification people. That product we put into this statute for a good reason, because it's the right one. We also want to make sure that this process, when it is done, is very clean and easy to understand, which I can tell you it isn't, but that's what we're shooting for. We want to have a system that works, so when people do have a legitimate transaction after a tax deed has been issued, that will at some point be able to guide them into being able to ensure title and ownership. One little point that I did want to point out in the new Section 8, I think there's an error in there, and it says, and this is the, if there's no successful sale, there's a cancellation. Well, down at the bottom there where it says, therefore, this tax lien is canceled. Not the tax lien that's canceled. It's the tax lien assignment that's canceled. So that should be corrected, because we can't cancel the lien, because that tax lien is what we call a super lien. It is the number one priority lien in the state, and it is above that first mortgage and everything else, so that's very important. We also want to reserve any amendments we want to look at very carefully. Like I said, we don't have a lot of problems with this. We just want to make sure we have a good idea. You may call me an informational witness in the end of this, but I do appreciate all of your work and all the work that was done on the interim, and I appreciate my good representative bringing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gowan. Further proponents in person? How about online, Ms. Murphy?
Mr. Chair, it looks like we have an opponent here who did not submit a request to testify. Would you like to recognize this person?
We've talked a little bit about that, to use it as a teaching moment, maybe, that people need to understand that they need to follow the rules. I'm inclined to allow it, although I'm getting some feedback not to. But I'll make an executive decision as the chair and allow it one time only, please.
Okay, Mr. Chair, we have Amy Gromelin.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. And I apologize. I had actually sent a note to Ms. Murphy that I was taking the spot of a prior person who had actually put in 24 hours in advance. I know that's probably a gray area. He's a client of the firm who was unable to testify in his spot. His name is Jared Hollinger. So if you would like me to stop speaking, I'm more than happy to do that. I'm happy to continue speaking on his behalf.
Proceed. Please spell your name, who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Gromelis, G-R-M-O-L-J-E-Z, and I'm a partner at the Crowley Fleck Law Firm. We represent 11 talents. Jared Hollinger submitted testimony through his legal counsel, Eli Patton, one of my partners out of the Billings office, and he is the head of our banking and credit group at the law firm. We too have been working on this issue for the last two sessions and want to thank the chair for bringing this forward, recognizing that the interim process was unlike any I've seen in 20 years. So apologize for not being able to stand up as a proponent. Our concerns, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we rise in opposition based on Section 6 and 9. Section 9 of the bill for our banking clients, we have already broached this with the proponents. We do not believe that Title 15-18-221 subsection 3 should be deleted. It interferes with the process that's been described in terms of liens and how it moves forward in the banking and credit section. And then Section 6, we would have a minor amendment to as well, and we can discuss that afterwards with the chair and the members that are proponents. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Grimalis. Any other opponents that are out there?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. How about informational witnesses at this point? Any informational witnesses?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We're checking to see if we have any in person. No, we have none in person. Okay. Members of the committee, I think Representative Dunwell, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No,
I thought I saw a hand up was all.
I apologize.
Members of the committee? Questions, comments? I'm sorry, Representative Fern?
This might be a question for Ms. Romo, if you're still there.
Ms. Romo, please.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Romo, did you hear the comments by the opponent, Ms. Gromulis, concerning a section that was that they opposed? Were you able to hear that? And if you did, could you comment on that from the perspective of the treasurers?
Mr. Chair, I can't. One of the sections that she mentioned, I believe, has to do with removing the discussion or the verbiage about liens. It is our feeling, two reasons. It's our feeling that we're not in a position where we should be determining whose lien is or should be prioritized. The second reasoning is that throughout the process of processing an assignment, by the time a piece of property should or gets to the point of an auction, there shouldn't be any lien holders involved at all. They are notified long before the redemption period expires. And if there is a lien holder still involved at that point, then it is my guess that they did not record their lien with the clerk and recorder, and there was no information that the litigation guarantee showed that they were an interested party. Or I've also seen where lien holders have determined that the amount they have outstanding on the debt is less than what the property or what the outstanding debt, the tax debt, is. Does that, hopefully that answers the question?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Further committee questions? Representative Trevis?
Thank you. I have two questions. I think the one that popped out to me was on page 14, line 6, about unclaimed property and surplus funds. It strikes the part here that surplus funds are considered to be unclaimed property, and if not claimed within 5 years, they... And that's completely struck. So I guess my question is, what happens if you can't find the title holder? And in that...
Senator Trevis, who's your question for? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Probably someone with either the sponsor or Ms. Romo, probably.
Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Trevis, I don't know if that would be a response best coming from Ms. Romo or Ms. Megan, but I will leave it to those two experts to respond.
Ms. Romo or Ms. Moore, who would like to tackle that, please?
This is Betty. Mr. Chair?
Yes. Go ahead, Ms. Romo.
So what would happen is Well, first of all, I don't believe as we've amended the bill that we're the auction proceeds would have to go to the currently occupied by the legal title holder. As long as that is the verbiage that carries through the bill, there really shouldn't be any problem with finding the owner. The reason that verbiage was struck is that local governments are exempt from the abandoned property law. The other thing is that money would remain with the county until a person is found. And once the person is found, it would be dispersed to them.
That makes sense. Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Trevis?
Slightly different question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably also directed to Ms. Romo. On page 11 and 12, there, about the cancellation piece, and I'm a little lost on some of this, so... But my question that I had, just out of curiosity, was that are there any long-standing, undesirable, say no bidders ever type of tax delinquent property that you know of that just kind of sit out there? And how does that, what do you do with that,
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Romo.
Okay. Are you referring to property that has current assignments on it, or are you referring to property that it just sits out there delinquent?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Romo, just sits out there delinquent.
Yes. Okay, Mr. Chair. Yes. Just in my county, we have several properties that are delinquent back to 10 years. The law does allow us to start writing those off after they have passed 10 years. We have a old oil refinery that literally nobody wants, even the owner. And we have burnt out properties. So what happens with those is they just remain on the tax roll. And every so often, we go out and write the taxes off to clean up the receivables. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Romo. Further questions from the committee at this point? Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Beard, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I want to thank you for a good hearing. A lot of good information came by, and now we're all more confused than ever. this House Bill 23 has been in the works through the Revenue Interim Committee pretty solidly since August. So all of the interested parties were all working together starting in August to get this language drafted and good solid form before it got to this committee today. Everyone has been afforded great amounts of input, and that has been reflected with the work that has been provided by the Montana Association of County Treasurers. It has been within the last couple of weeks that we were hit with a voluminous amount of, oh, well, what if it says this and what if it says that? A lot of those issues didn't pertain to this immediate concern from the results of Senate Bill 253. Some of those concerns were my concerns back when I voted no on Senate Bill 253 because it did not include this language of clarification in today's House Bill 23. So that's why I'm a sponsor of today's bill, and having just this recent deluge of changes presented, proposed to this bill
perhaps are better addressed in a separate bill. And I would just like to say that I appreciate the concerns of the two proponents. The second opponent that we heard from today, or the first opponent that we heard from today, had a word that he'd like to have inserted into the text, and I would be amenable to further discussion about that. But in the meantime, I think that this bill has a lot of support. You heard 56 county treasurers from across this state are in support of House Bill 23. They want to strengthen the tax lien and tax deed laws, and I sincerely request that our committee members give a due pass on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Beard. We'll stand in recess here for just a couple of minutes till Chairman Beard can get back to the table.
I'll tell you about it, too. That's why I added, I revised my clothes. Members of the committee, I would like to take a five-minute break before we set up for our next part of today's agenda. So please be quick and be back here in 5 minutes in your seats. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, can I just tell the people on Zoom that I emailed you a link to join the meeting directly yesterday afternoon? Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're joining another meeting that requires a separate meeting link, and that link has been emailed to you. So those of you on Zoom can just click on that link to join the meeting. Those in the room will be able to sit in the room and view the meeting from there.
So, Megan, I have a question, please. Regarding procedure, do we then just log out of this current link?
Madam Chair, Representative Dunwell, yes, just click to leave this meeting and then click on the other link. That meeting is in progress now.
We'll still be considered participating in the meeting.
Madam Chair, Representative Dunwell, yes, you're invited to that meeting. It's not a joint meeting or anything like that, so there's no roll call or anything.
Okay, but we haven't adjourned this one. We haven't adjourned this meeting.
Madam Chair, Representative Dunwell, I believe the chair is about to do so.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Megan. You're wonderful. Oh, Megan, can I just ask you real quick? Could I submit an amendment to House Bill 23, unless the sponsor would like to do it, just to add the word assignment at the end of tax, the word tax lien, the two words tax liens on new Section 8, line 28. It was a request by William Galen.
Yes, Representative Dunwell.
Thank you, Megan.
$1 million castle would go to paying for that school, so you could do it with a lot fewer mills. That's a silly example, but it could be pipelines or a very expensive residential development. There could be lots of reasons that there's more value, for example, that would draw down this number of mills. There's other examples where the school may just cost less to run. So you may have less mills in the school district. And say there's a city over there that also has fewer mills. Say it has 107 mills as opposed to 126 mills. Maybe it's better run. Maybe they don't have a library because we all have Netflix now and who needs to read? Who knows? There are fewer mills in this city. But if we assume, or if we think that this house, this $200,000 house, you didn't build it there, maybe you built it over in this city, in this school district. You are both having fewer city mills and fewer school mills. In addition, you're not in, say, this 23-mill district. In this situation, it could be the exact same house. It could even be next door, assuming those district lines split you. This person would pay $400 less in total taxes. So that's how you get a fairly substantial differences in taxes, even though you've got the same value and the same rate as you were set. And that's an important distinction when you're looking at how taxes are calculated. But that's the basis, or that's the basics of how a tax bill is created: market value, the tax rate, and the combination of mills of where you are. That's about all I have to say about the basics of that. I would be happy to take questions, or
first, please,
I can pass
seated.
It on to Julia or Amy for a deeper dive into the school portion of this.
Members, please be seated so we can resume. We're a half hour behind on our agenda.
So we can either do Megan next or Julia, whichever you want to do first. Julia, actually, it might be simpler to have Julia just stay on after we're Megan, so then let Megan go next.
Okay.
Megan needs to be led into the room.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Are you ready for my presentation? Okay.
Go ahead.
Marla?
Yeah,
she's up. This is Division. I'm a research analyst, and I serve as a staff for the House Taxation Committee and the Revenue Interim Committee. And the items I'm going to discuss today are a property tax history and property tax limits. There are some materials posted on the Section E website, and I'm going to speak from those materials generally, and these were prepared for the HJ35 Tax Study Committee that met over the interim. And I'll start with the property tax history. This history is from about 1972 until today. And the reason the year 1972 is selected is because the adoption of the 1972 Constitution changed some provisions related to property tax, specifically requiring the state to appraise, assess, and equalize the valuation of property. Before 1972, that appraisal was a county function, and state law did require the values to be updated continuously, but counties varied in their adherence to that requirement. Also, I want to point out that in the 1972 Constitution, the State Board of Equalization was replaced with the Department of Revenue and the State Tax Appeal Board. The independent function of appeal function in the State Tax Appeal Board is required in the 1972 Constitution. For this property tax history presentation, I'm going to discuss a few different trends in the property tax history. That's a departure from the document that's provided on the website. That document is just presented in chronological order. And the first trend I'm going to discuss is simplification. And this has two parts: simplification of the property that's taxable, and then simplification in the property tax calculation. The taxable property has changed to some extent beginning in 1973, when the legislature exempted Freeport merchandise from taxation. Then in 1974, the legislature exempted household goods and personal property used for domestic purposes. Prior to that time, your clothing would have been subject to property taxes, and you can imagine that that was a nightmare to administer for the Department of Revenue. In 2000, the legislature phased down the Class 6 tax rate. Class 6 is business inventories and unprocessed agricultural products. And that rate was phased down so that it was fully repealed by 2003. And then the business equipment tax has been reduced in tax years 1989, 1995, 1999. In 2011, and then in 2000 and 2013, the legislature increased the exemption for business equipment tax, so this would be the portion of business equipment that's not subject to taxation. Next, I'll discuss the property tax calculation. In 1977, the legislature expanded the number of classes, and that doesn't sound like a simplification, but it was because it allowed the removal of a second calculation that was required to get the taxable value. Then the next two things I'm going to discuss were actually complications that were enacted over this period, but then they have since been repealed. In 1997 and 1999, the legislature decided to phase in a property tax value. So, for example, when reappraisal happened, if your value increased, you would only pay your taxes on a portion of that increase over the reappraisal cycle, so that by the end of the cycle, the value would be fully phased in, but you wouldn't see that increase in value in the first year. In 1999, the legislature enacted a homestead and comstead exemption. This was a percentage of value that was exempt from taxation, so that would be subtracted off the market value before the tax rate was applied. But in 2015, the legislature removed both the phase-in and the homestead and comstead exemption. And that was in a two-year reappraisal bill. And that made it so that the tax value calculation was simply taxable value equals market value times tax rate. The second trend is appraisal cycle variability. Since the 1972 Constitution, we've had reappraisal cycles of varying lengths, and I'll give you some examples. In 1975, there was a five-year reappraisal cycle, but then the legislature in the next two reappraisal cycles extended both of those by 2 years, making them a seven-year cycle. Then in 1991, the legislature enacted a three-year cycle, but the Supreme Court changed it to 4 years in 1992. In 1997, the legislature delayed the next reappraisal cycle for classes 3, 4, and 10 property, which is residential, commercial, agricultural, and forest property, to 2007. So that would have been a 10-year cycle. But in 1999, just 2 years later, the legislature adopted a 6-year reappraisal cycle. Then in 2015, the legislature adopted a 2-year reappraisal cycle for residential, commercial, and agricultural property. Forest property remains on the 6-year cycle, and all other property is reappraised annually. The third trend is what I refer to as enactment and loosening of limits. In 1986, the citizens of Montana enacted I-105, which limited property taxes to 1986 levels. And the 1987 legislature had to pass some enacting legislation to make that initiative work. Then in 1997, the legislature changed the base year for those limits from 1986 to 1996 and also allowed voters to approve a levy above the limit. In 1999, the legislature further expanded the limit on taxes by allowing taxing jurisdictions to implement a mill levy sufficient to generate the revenue assessed in the prior year. And then in 2001, the legislature further expanded that limit to allow for a levy sufficient to generate the revenue assessed in the prior year plus an inflationary increase, which is half the rate of inflation for the previous 3 years. And then also allowed for carry forward of unused mill levy authority to a future year. The fourth trend is in the statewide education levies, and I didn't get to listen to your presentation this morning. Mr. McCracken or someone else may have discussed this, but in 1983, the legislature increased the elementary mill levies from 25 to 28 and the high school levies from 15 to 17. And then in 1989, the 40 mills for state equalization were enacted and the elementary mills were increased to 33 and the high school levies to 22. The last item isn't a trend, it's just a miscellaneous item I'd like to identify, and that is that in 1973, the legislature provided that the agricultural property would be assessed on productive value rather than market value. And Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation on the property tax history, and if you have questions about that, I'm happy to take them at this time, or I can move on to property tax limits if there are no questions.
Do we have questions here? Ms. Moore, please continue.
Nope.
I think the room 472 mic might be muted and we can't hear you.
No, I have it unmuted again. Can you hear us?
Talk to Mike Freeman a little bit. We can hear you guys now.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Okay.
Looks like Senator Hoeven has a question.
Is Senator Hoeven there?
Yes. Yes.
Please go on, yeah, Senator Hoeven.
Megan, what was that MCA code for half the rate of inflation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoeven, that's 1510-420.
1510-420. Well, one of the things that comes up, and it wasn't, Mr. Brown kind of alluded to it, but it wasn't fully explained by Mr. Paddington. What happens right now is the two-year reappraisal, when the reappraisal goes into effect, the property values go up, taxable value goes up, and so the counties, because they are limited on how much money they can receive, they reduce their levies, they reduce their mills. So the increase in tax, city and county tax, to the property owner is fairly small. It's one half the rate of inflation. However, with the 101 mills, the 95 and the 6, those mills go as is. They don't reduce. No one reduces those mills. So that is one of the reasons that the first year of the reappraisal, you see an increase in property tax, because that 101 mills is roughly 16% or in that neighborhood of 15-20% of an individual's total property tax. So the first year of reappraisal, you'll see a spike because the statewide mills stay the same. Those are not reduced. And that's one of the reasons that we see property taxes continually creeping up all the time on reappraisal.
Mr. Chairman, is there a question? Okay. Ms. Moore?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoeven, I was going to say, I didn't hear a question there, but yes, you're correct. Those education mill levies are set in statute.
Okay, anything else that anybody wants to ask? I do not see anything. Anthony, do you see anything out there?
Mr. Chair, there appears to be no hands raised.
Okay. Ms. Moore, are you to continue? Are you next or to continue on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe so.
Oh, please do.
And I read some allusions to trouble sharing the screen. Is that correct, or should I not attempt to do so?
go ahead and attempt it, please. I think we had that figured out. Okay. Whether we still do is something we'll find out.
Can you see a property tax calculation on the screen?
Yep, thank you.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's going to be simple. I'm just going to leave that up while I'm speaking because I think it'll help you understand the property tax limits. As I said in the earlier presentation, in 1986, Montana voters enacted Initiative 105 to limit property taxes to 1986 levels. And many other states also enacted property tax limits around that time, following California voters' approval of Proposition 13 in 1978. And today, 46 states and the District of Columbia limit property taxes in some form. There are three types of property tax limits that I'm going to discuss today. Those are assessment limits, rate limits, and levy limits. And I'm going to discuss them generally, and then I'm going to discuss Montana's limits specifically. The first type of limit is an assessment limit, and this is a limit on the assessed value of property, and it prevents taxes from increasing as property values increase. So what we're talking about here is the market value being limited. And the way that would work is there would be some portion of value that would be subtracted from the market value before the tax rate is applied. So what that means is that even if the tax rate or the mill rate increase, if the property tax, the market value is limited, then the property taxes will not increase. 18 states have assessment limits. And assessment limits may benefit taxpayers with limited income and introduce a notion of ability to pay into the property tax system. On the other hand, assessment limits can introduce inequity into the system to the extent that they limit assessed values for some taxpayers and not others. States vary at the level in which the assessment limits are set and to whom they apply. California's assessment limit is the lesser of 2% or the rate of inflation, while Minnesota's assessment limit is 15%. Assessment limits do place a larger share of property tax burden on new construction, and they can result in large variations in assessed value based on the length of ownership of the property. Some states that have assessment limits apply it to property while it's under the same ownership, and then upon sale, the property is reassessed. This may create what we call the lock-in effect, in which homeowners who choose not to sell their homes and buy new homes because of the property tax implications of selling. There are some attempts to alleviate this concern. California allows the transfer of a principal residence to a relative without triggering a reassessment. And they also allow people 55 years old or older to transfer the assessed value of their current home to a different property of the same or lower value. Florida has a similar program, and it's not limited by age as it is in California. I also want to point out that assessment limits only prevent property taxes from rising to the extent that the mills and the tax rate remain constant. So even if you held the market value completely flat, if you increase the mill rate over here, the taxes are still going to increase. Next, I'll discuss rate limits. A rate limit is a limit on mill levies. So we're limiting this brown square here. The limit could apply to all levies collectively. It could apply to each taxing jurisdiction individually, or it could apply to only certain taxing jurisdictions. And in addition, some governments that have rate limits allow a mechanism for voters to increase a rate cap. And 36 states have rate limits. Rate limits are more neutral than assessment limits because similar properties are assessed similar taxes. Rate limits don't prevent property taxes from increasing if the property value increases. So if this goes up, even if you hold the mill rate constant, the taxes will increase. Also, policymakers that want to skirt rate limits may choose to increase the tax rate in order to raise property taxes. Rate limits can also result in the shifting of financial responsibilities. For example, if taxing jurisdictions are not all limited. The responsibility of one jurisdiction that's limited could shift to another jurisdiction that's not limited. Finally, I'll discuss levy limits. A levy limit caps revenue growth, usually by limiting the growth to a certain percentage or linking growth to inflation. So we're talking about the ultimate taxes paid are what are limited in a levy limit. The impact on taxpayers can vary based on a property's assessed value and also adjustments to the mill levies or the tax rate can have disparate effects on taxpayers, and 36 states have levy limits. The document that I provided online includes on page 3 a state-by-state inventory of which states have which types of limits. But now I'm going to discuss Montana's limits specifically. And I'll stop sharing. I don't think you need to see that anymore. Montana has a levy limit that's provided for in section 1510.420. That's the section Senator Colvin just asked me about. And this limit provides that a taxing jurisdiction may levy a mill levy sufficient to generate the amount of property taxes actually assessed in the prior year plus one half of the average rate of inflation for the prior 3 years. This levy limit is calculated excluding the newly taxable value of property. And then once the mill levy is calculated, it applies to all the property in the jurisdiction, the new property and the existing property. So that allows a small additional inflationary adjustment. In addition, if a taxing jurisdiction doesn't levy the maximum authorized mill levy, they may carry it forward to a future tax year. And there's also a provision in law to allow a local government to exceed the levy limit upon an affirmative vote of the taxing jurisdiction. Also, there are some exceptions to the levy limit, such as judgment levies, emergency levies, levies to repay taxes under protest, and the school levies are also not subject to this levy limit. Montana also has a rate limit, and this is what Senator Hovind was talking about for statewide education mill levies. This is considered to be a limit because those mills are set in statute, and they may not increase unless the legislature increases them. However, as he indicated, if the property values increase and the mill levies remain the same, the collections will increase over time. And we do not have an assessment limit in Montana. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Chairman. Megan, and just a curiosity I have, so the 95 and the 6 mills, the state mills, when we looked at our 20 years worth of data growth, grew at about 3.1% annually over that time frame, if I remember what the data looked like, which is about CPI and population. At that same time, the county and the city mills and the schools even were capped, right? The counties and cities are capped at half the rate of inflation, grew at about 6% annually over that time frame, that same time frame. And the schools themselves were like at 4.25 or some numbers, slightly north of 4. And so I guess it's interesting because if the counties and cities and schools are growing at a rate that exceeds their half the rate of inflation cap substantially, yet their cap, yet 95 and the 6 are not capped, yet they're growing at about half the rate of the counties and the cities. How do we reconcile that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, I would point to two possibilities. One is that voted levies are allowed. There can be increases in the general levy that's allowed and also additional mill levies. And then the second thing is under 1510.420, that calculation is made on the existing property value. And so if there's growth in the county, for example, that wouldn't be included when the mill levy is set. However, the rate would then apply to that growth in value. So that can increase the revenue collections because of the way that newly taxable property is excluded when the mill levy is calculated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Megan. Wouldn't that impact the 95 the same? Wouldn't it pick up the increased taxable value? If you add additional market or taxable value, that applies to the 95 as well, does it not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, yes, you're correct. I guess I was getting more at how it could increase greater than the inflationary amount. But yes, the taxable property would also be subject to those 95 mils and 60.
Yeah, it's. I get the increase as the market value and the taxable value pulls everything. It's the numbers are the one side. They're dang. Well, the county and city is darn near double the 95 in the state, and it'd be interesting to see exactly how that was achieved. Potentially, there's some TIF districts that are being excluded, et cetera, but it's interesting differential.
Okay, let's see. Nope, Senator McClaffrey had a question, but she got it answered. So any other questions out there that we can see or in the room here? I do not see any, so Ms. Moore, thank you. I think is that the end of your presentation?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you so much. And I believe it's Ms. Patton. Is that your next presenter?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Julia Patton with the Legislative Fiscal Division. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah, I believe so.
So I will be sharing first a PowerPoint that it generally goes over property taxes and a little bit of schools. Let me see if I can share my screen.
Also, to interrupt very briefly, I believe room 152 is now unmuted, so if anybody in room 152 has a question, you guys can speak as well.
Can everyone see my screen?
Yes, it looks great.
Okay, great. So, actually, I should back up. This was as part of a presentation that I gave last January during Legislative Week to the MARA Committee. So if you're interested in seeing more slides and the accompanying report, those are available on the MARA page on our website. I believe it's under the Legislative Finance Committee subcommittees, and then there's a specific page for MARA. So the first slide that I wanted to go over was a difference between total market value and the total taxes paid for different property classes. Montana has about 15 or 16 different classes. And here, a majority of those different classes have been condensed down into all other types of property, just for the sake of simplicity. The largest in terms of market value and in taxes paid is residential, followed by all other types, which are a combination of a bunch of smaller ones. And then depending on whether you're talking about total market value or total taxes paid, commercial and Class 9 oil pipelines are big players in property tax. You'll notice there's a difference in the shares of the pie charts. So residential property is taking up about 2/3 of total market value, but accounts for just less than half of the total taxes paid. And the big difference you'll see in other classes is Class 9 oil pipelines, which accounts for about 2.8% of the total market value, but 14.8% of the total taxes paid. That looks a little bit low, but anyway. So the major difference here is that they are taxed at different statutory tax rates. Residential is taxed at 1.35% of market value versus 12% of market value for oil pipelines. So on this slide, you'll see that, and I hope you can see the far right side of the slide, it's not covered up, but Carter County on the far right pays the largest amount per capita, so per person, in property taxes. Now, keep in mind that when you see this $10,000, your average resident of Carter County is not paying $10,000 in property taxes. They, you know, assuming they're paying residential property taxes only, they're paying this small blue portion at the bottom. So a household of four people might be paying approximately four times that, which is still less than $2,000, given that this is per capita. Madison County, you'll notice, is paying the largest amount in residential property taxes per capita, and that's due in large part to the presence of the Yellowstone Club and Big Sky. So this chart looks very similar, but instead of taxes paid, we are now looking at market value by county. And so when you look at market value in this case, Madison County on the far right has a higher total market value per capita than Carter County. And the difference in order that you're going to see between the past chart and then this one are due to those differences in statutory tax rates. And so then the third chart I have by county is broken down by mills for different entities. So each entity, the state, county, city, school district, and special district in each taxing jurisdiction can levy a certain number of mills on properties. So Montana law requires counties to levy a certain county equalization mill, that's the 55 mills, and the state equalization levy of 40 mills, and those are commonly referred to as the 95 mills for education. They also levy 6 mills for the university system, which are lumped in with the yellow here. And note that the hatched bars, which yellow is hatched, it's kind of hard to tell here potentially, and the orange and the hatched purple are designated for schools. So the major takeaway here is probably that mill rates vary from location to location. They depend on the sum of the mills levied by the different taxing units where property is located. There are about 12,000 different taxing entities in Montana. We have the state, 56 different counties, 128 municipalities, 350 school districts, and hundreds of special districts. So this is actually a weighted average because within a county, mill levies can vary whether you're in a city or not, or which school district you're in. So some counties may have only four or five different levy districts and others may have 30. Local governments can impose permissive levies subject to a variety of different legal restrictions, some of which stem from the Property Tax Limitation Initiative 105 from 30 years ago. Local governments can also impose voted levies, which are voted on and approved by voters. So the mill levies can vary for a number of reasons. Property value is a big one. Property class makeup, and then government spending or local choice. So jurisdictions with less property value may have to levy more mills just to collect the same amount of revenue as a jurisdiction with greater property value. And then when you look at property class makeup, a county with more oil pipeline wealth may levy fewer mills because of the higher statutory tax rate. And that means that each mill is worth more on average. And then finally, you have local choice. Certain local governments may, or the voters and residents of certain local governments may want their government to provide more services and thus spend more, and in turn need to raise more revenue to support expenditures. Some communities are just more willing to pay higher taxes than others are. And then the last source of variation we can look at is schools. Schools are subject to a variety of different restrictions stemming from court cases and the legislative responses, as you heard from Pat and Laura. And Amy and I will talk later on about the different sources of variation in school mills. So this slide is a comparison of those three charts. It's a little bit hard to read because I had to condense it down, but there is a version in a PDF in the materials section of the website where all three charts have county labels. I think it's just a useful comparison because here you can see Madison County, you can look at the taxes paid, the total market value and then the number of mills versus a county like Cascade, which has a higher number of mills, but lower total market value per capita and lower taxes paid per capita. So again, if you're interested in looking at and having a direct comparison, there's a much better version to look at on the website. So I cherry picked a few examples. Nothing particularly interesting from these aside or special about these aside from the fact that I picked Madison and Carter counties because they have a very high market value per capita. And you'll notice they levy lower mills than say Cascade, Missoula, or Bighorn counties. But when you look at the market value of these, the lower market value counties and lower taxes paid per capita have higher mills. And that's just due to the difference in taxable value and then the different value of a mill. So they have to levy the same or more mills to get the same amount of revenue. So this chart just shows the growth over time in different types of mills that we just saw on the last slide. I have the compound annual growth rates, which I think Representative Jones was referring to earlier. So the lower line here is inflation adjusted for population. And then that gray line is the growth in the economy or personal income in this case. And as you can see, the growth in the 95 mills, which have remained stagnant over the last 20 years, has pretty closely followed inflation adjusted for population. For school districts here, you'll note that there's a bit of a jump in 2017. That was due to a GTB change, which you can read in about in more detail in the school's property tax report from, I believe, April 2020. And it also was combined with a jump in debt service and building reserve mills for several construction projects that were going on in schools or for new schools around the state. And then this slide shows the exact same thing, but for local governments. So you'll notice counties and cities and towns have slightly higher compound annual growth rates that are above the rate of growth in the economy. Special district levies was particularly high for its compound annual growth rate, but it accounts for a very small total dollar amount when compared to these other six categories. But it's still interesting to look at. And then the last slide, this was also one from the January report. This is statewide effective tax rate. So effective tax rate is when we take total taxes paid divided by the market value. Statewide, there's an effective tax rate for residential property. So this is residential property only of about 0.84%. And you'll notice, I mean, the colors vary quite a bit, but if you look, we have mostly light blue in the light blue range to kind of orange range. So most jurisdictions, and again, we're looking at area here, not people, but or not population, but I think it's still relevant. Most are paying between about 0.6 and 0.9% as an effective tax rate for residential property. There are a few outliers. For example, in Sanders County, there's a jurisdiction that covers part of the Flathead Reservation, and market value doesn't include land on the reservation. So when we divide taxes paid by market value, there's a smaller denominator that results in a larger effective tax rate. And you can look at those cases similarly across this map. So that's all I have for you today until I get to the presentation with Amy next. And I'm happy to answer any questions, or we can hold them until the end.
Mr. Chairman, I do have one if I might.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, Julia, just since we're the school committee on that school bump, the 4.59, I just wanted to clarify that as the GTB comes back in, and you can speak to this, but as the GTB comes back in, that should neutralize through 2021, should it not? Because the GTB coming, the GTB numbers ratchet up incrementally in 20 through 21. And so that chart went through 19. The line should restabilize. Because what happened is the block grants went out, they reformed, and they came back in through the GTB, but they came in incremental. And so that should pressure that line down, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, that is correct. I have a graphic which I can either send to you or I can pull up here at the end or now, depending on what you guys would like, that shows the jump and what is projected to happen. But yes, that should return to normal as of 2021. These charts just don't have those data.
Yeah, I just didn't want folks to take the impression that there was a long-term change occurring, that there was just a bump that was caused by a shortfall we addressed.
Okay, Ms. Patton, I had a question asked to me. I think it was, which website do you have this stuff on? They missed when you said where they could find this.
Oh, Mr. Chair, this is on the Section E Appropriations Subcommittee Materials tab, this presentation. And then if you are interested in looking at the property tax and school funding reports from the interim, those are under the Legislative Finance Committee on the Legislative Fiscal Division webpage. I can show you if I share my screen.
Julia?
Yeah.
It's also in that other fiscal reports. We kind of curated down to under property. So if you go to the LFD page, mm-hmm. and then you go to the other fiscal reports or something like that, it's kind of in the middle of the screen. And then there's property taxes. There's a whole bunch of list of all of the things, you know, the core reports that generated the same things for the materials today.
Yeah. So, here's an example of the extended version that I mentioned earlier. So under, where is it, Amy? Under the Legislative Fiscal Division website.
Yep. And then under other fiscal policy reports, that one. Yeah, click there.
Okay.
And then go to property taxes. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So, they should be under here, I think. There are a few of them. There's a story map. They're all named fairly similarly, but.
And we can add the things that we did today to this list.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Carlson and Ms. Patton. We appreciate that. It was just a question. Someone wanted to be able to go back and look at these. So.
Great.
We've got it for them. Thank you very much. Are there other questions out there?
Mr. Chair, I don't see any hands raised, but I'd like to double check with room 152 to make sure they don't have any questions.
No questions from 152. Thank you.
Okay. We're set to move forward. Is it Ms. Carlton now or Ms. Patton?
Yeah. You'll get a tag team.
Oh, boy.
Mr. Chair, I will share my screen if that's okay, since it seems to be working.
Please do.
Amy and I will go over this together.
I'll start talking while Julia's bringing that up, just so we don't waste any more of your time than necessary. So I'm Amy Carlson, Legislative Fiscal Analyst. I've been working on school funding and property taxes since the mid-90s, which sort of dates me, right? Kind of a dinosaur in the world of state government these days. But I'm going to try to kind of bring up a higher level view that kind of hopefully connects some of the dots, because you've been given a lot of information about school funding, about property taxes. And I hope to kind of bring it up and connect some of these higher level concepts for you that hopefully tie things together. So Julia's brought up the first page. And I did want to mention that Julie and I are presenting this, but Pad McCracken contributed significantly to this report and is definitely a part of it. If you have any detailed questions, you're going to need to refer to him. But this is really trying to tie school funding and property taxes together. So can you go to the next slide? So there's about $1.9 billion in property taxes. The majority of that, or 57%, goes to K-12 school districts. You can see in this chart all the hashed sections go to schools. the statewide school mills, 16% or $300 million, the countywide schools, and then the school district component, school mills themselves at 34%. And then counties, you can see at 27%, cities at 10%, et cetera. The higher education actually includes both the state higher education and then also community colleges. One of the interesting things, and you compare this to some of the other charts that Julie was showing, but I did these same numbers for the year 2000 or fiscal year 2000 using the DOR biennial report. And the two sections of this that changed the most are the school state school section was 22% in 2000, and the county school section was, or the county section was 21%. So they kind of swapped places to some extent. So just an interesting thing to add to the mix. So school funding substantially impacts property taxes is kind of what this says, right? So in the next slide, we talk about, Pat talked to you about this a lot, and Laura as well, about that school funding is constitutionally required. So the legislature, this is a quote from the Constitution, the legislature shall provide a basic system of free quality public elementary and secondary schools and distribute its share to those school districts. What's interesting and different about school funding is two sides. One, on the tax side, is like property taxes, as you know, is so the difference, say, between property tax and income tax is the state sets all the income tax rates and they apply evenly to all citizens of the state. On property taxes, it's partially state set and it's also partially set by all the local jurisdictions. Similarly, on the funding side, if you compare school funding to, say, Medicaid or corrections or some other state service, the services are going to be provided uniformly across the state. But in the case of school funding, it's partially uniformly supported and then partially up to the local district. So we'll go into some of that in a little more specifics. Julia, the next slide, please. This slide talks about the different school district budgeted funds. I think PAD went into this in more detail, but just kind of going through them one by one, you can see adult education, tiny, building reserve, very small, bus depreciation, small, debt service, okay, we're getting into some bigger dollars. The general fund base is just the base portion of the general fund budget, and then the next column over is the general fund over base. You can see in the general fund base column, the green portion is the amount levied by the school district or the school district funds going into it. So this is all funds, not just property taxes, but all funds. And then the next piece up in the general fund base budget is property taxes from the state. And then on top of that, you have other state funds because the property taxes don't cover all the state share of school districts. It also takes other state general fund and other funds to pay for that obligation. You see there's a two on top of this general fund base column, and there's also a two on top of retirement. Those two we'll be talking about in more detail, as those are what we consider kind of core pieces of the basic system of a quality education. So those two in particular, the state focuses in on guaranteeing some elements, and we'll get into that in a minute. So the and then the next column over from the general fund base is the over base, so the optional kind of part of the general fund budget. Then we talked about retirement. Then you have technology, which is a small amount. Transportation, as you can see, transportation is mostly school district funded, but there's a little bit of state and county, and then tuition fund. On the next slide, it just reiterates the fact that of the state funding that goes to schools, about a third of that is property taxes, and the other two-thirds of that are other state resources. Not going into the details about that at this point. So the next slide shows the different school funds again, but grouped into whether the state has a substantial participation in those funds or not. So you can see the green, the solid green bar is where the state has no participation in those funds. So we're talking the general fund overbase, levies, adult education, and tuition. And then there's kind of a variation of getting more and more blue across from a little bit of state funding to full state funding. So then there's some more local district choice kinds of things, you know, where there's a small amount of state funding like debt service, technology, and transportation. Then you get into something where the state has a significant stake, but not the full payment of it in the guaranteed, the countywide guaranteed tax base aid. And then in the next final next column over is where there's a state guaranteed tax base portion of the base budget, the general fund base budget. And the final are the components that the state pays directly. So general fund, direct state aid, the new components of school funding, which I'm sure Pad talked about, and then the pension direct payments to schools. I should have mentioned this under the previous slide, but or a couple of slides ago, but the state contributes not just to the retirement levy or the retirement funds directly in school districts. The state has a component where that we put money directly into the pension systems on behalf of the school districts. So the next slide then. So this talks about some of the statutory drivers in school funding that affect property taxes. And one is just location, you know, that there is a location of a school district and the tax laws associated with what are the taxable values associated with the properties in that district. Next, we have things like guaranteed tax base aid that try to equalize between taxpayers in different districts. And we'll talk about GTB a bit more in a second. And then there are different caps and maximums on most school district funds. So the cap on how much property taxes can be levied in a particular fund. So then the next slide. So this is just another way to group the different types of levies. And again, you're going to kind of get into those basic system of quality education ideas, right? So in the first column are the required mills, and those required mills are things about that basic system of quality education. So there is required mills are required, and they're kind of the minimums. Then there's this area of permissive. So the school district trustees have the opportunity or choice to levy these mills or not. There's, of course, rules associated with that, but those mills are that. Building reserve has some permissive portion, and it also has a voted portion. So the group of levies on the final column are voted by the taxpayers. So school district above base mills, debt service, portion of the building reserve, flexibility, technology, items like that. In the next slide, we'll start talking more specifically about guaranteed tax base aid. Again, it is guaranteed tax base aid is for required mills. They aren't for the optional sorts of things, at least the way statute reads today. The guaranteed tax base aid are only for those things that are required by the state, by the school districts. Guaranteed tax base aid averages up, meaning it gives taxpayers sort of equal purchasing power for the services for their school districts up into a point, up until the guaranteed tax base aid area of the budget. So it creates greater taxpayer equity, and it also provides greater equity for students, as I know that Pad talked about a little bit in his presentation. So the next slide talks about how you can compare or how different districts are impacted by guaranteed tax base aid. So on this slide, you can see two different districts, and these are just example districts, but they're realistic examples. In the first example, you have a high taxable value wealth district. They are levying 55 mils for their guaranteed tax base aid area, but they're providing most of the value or the budget or the dollars for that to fill that budget locally, meaning the green portion is representing the local mills, and they're generating quite a bit of most of that revenue. And there's just a little bit of state portion on top. The next district over is a low taxable wealth district, and they're also levying 55 mils because that GTB levy equalizes up. So while 55 mils only generates a small portion
of the budget necessary to fill up the base budget. So that generates that small portion. The state fills up the rest of that GTB area. So that in both cases, you can see that they have equal mills, but different different results. In another example, you can have very high taxable value districts where they have so much taxable value that the state contributes nothing to them in GTB, but they may only have to levy 5 mills because they have so much taxable value per student, per their cost of their education, that they only have to levy, say, 5 mills. In another example, you might have maybe not a ton of taxable value, but a ton of non-levy revenue, where a district has their budget filled up with non-levy revenue, and then just a small share between state and local government getting that 5 mils for that example. So those are just some different examples. Julia's going to run you through some specifics in a few minutes to give you some sense of some actual factual examples. If you go to the next slide, this slide really talks about we will take a break in just a couple of minutes because I think some people want to go to the governor's press conference. But I think you'll get into the details here in a minute. So hopefully you'll come back when we can come back. So the school district taxes by budgeted fund, you can see that where the school district budget, the billion dollars plus of school district property taxes, which fund they land into. So adult education all the way down to tuition. Again, the bulk of the property taxes land in the general fund with the general fund base and the general fund over base. So then if you want to go to the next slide, and this slide is probably the place where we would want to take a break if we wanted to take a break and talk about when we dig into the details of what causes the variation for the different school mills, whether it's local choice, taxable value per student, non-levy revenue, or the cost to provide those services. So I think before we jump into Julia's part of the presentation, if you wanted to take a break, we could do that. Chairman?
Yes, Ms. Carlson, do people all want to go see this and leave the presentation, or would you like us to recess and come back when it's over, or should we just leave it till tomorrow? Kind of being you're the presenter, I would. How long is the rest of your presentation?
Not more than 15 minutes, I don't think. And then you may have questions, but I'd say not more than 15. Yeah, probably about 15 minutes.
I think anybody that would like to go again to the press conference or to watch it, et cetera, I think they can just go and do that. Maybe we'll just soldier on and get this over to the point that we can get this part done so we don't have to try and reschedule something, which is okay. Always an interesting little venture. So I would prefer that if anybody would like to go to that, feel free to go, but we'd like to get to the end of this so that we don't have to try, like we said, reschedule.
We can do that. So Julia, you can take it over from here.
Okay, great. Thanks, Amy. So here are four main reasons for variation in mills for schools. We have local choice, taxable value per student, non-levy revenue, and different costs to provide services. So I'm going to walk through some examples at different levels, state, county, and school district. Again, like I said, there are differences at the county level and at the district level. At the state level, state mills are identical across the state, so all taxpayers are paying 95 mills. And so as Nick mentioned in his introduction, he had an example with a $200,000 house. One mil for a $200,000 house is $2.70. And so for the same educational services, all residents of a $200,000 house would be paying about $257, and that is statewide. Countywide school mills vary across the state. You can see that there are counties who are paying zero and counties who are paying up to 75. So again, with this one mill for a $200,000 house, if you have the same educational services, residents of a $200,000 house are paying somewhere between $0 and $207 for the countywide school mills. And we'll walk through some examples of the variation at the county level. The first example is in taxable value per student. Gallatin County levies approximately 41 countywide school mills versus 9 in Madison County. There's a difference in total taxable value. Gallatin County's taxable value is actually higher than Madison's, but when you average it per student or divide it by the number of students, per student, Gallatin County has about $25,000 in taxable value, and Madison County has about $158,000. And so they need to levy fewer mills in Madison County to get the same revenue per student that Gallatin County does. The second example is non-levy revenue. So in Macon County, they're levying approximately 43 countywide school mills versus zero in Richland County. I have a comparison in their taxable values here for you to look at, but the key is really looking at their non-levy revenue per student. So the non-levy revenue in Macon County is about $3,000 versus about $2.4 million in Richland. And therefore, when you combine property taxes and non-levy revenue for the two counties, Macon is paying has about $1,300 in countywide property tax per student versus 14 in non-levy revenue. And Richland has zero in countywide property tax per student, but about $1,100 per student in non-levy revenue. And so when you combine the two, you're looking at more comparable amounts. The third example here is the different costs to provide services. So in Garfield County, they're levying about 77 countywide school mills versus about 43 in Yellowstone County. Garfield is collecting about $1,500 per A&B versus about $900 in Yellowstone. So the countywide mills include transportation and retirement. This is probably a combination of both, but you'll see in the local school district example, which is a school district in Garfield versus a school district in Yellowstone County, that transportation is one of the major differences between the two. It just costs more in a more rural area than a more urban area. So here we have a map of mills statewide for different school districts. So for the same educational services, residents of a $200,000 house are paying between $48 and $941. So there's a much wider discrepancy here. And if you're interested, we have an interactive school mills map, which I can take a break and show you briefly. It is on the website, so this link will take you directly there. So can everyone see this?
Yes.
This is how it will pop up as soon as you click the link. You have a couple of options up here on the left-hand side. They are legend, about, and layers. About has some basic information for how to navigate, but I think it'll help for me to go through it with you. Oops. That's not what I wanted. So if we go to the layers, you can click different layers on and off if you want to. So we have the total school mills right now. It does not include the 95 equalization mills. And you can scroll to zoom in so we can pick an example. Maybe Lewis and Clark County, since that's where we are now. When you select a district, it will bring up the countywide school mills. It'll tell you that the levy district is just an identifier. It's not something you have to worry about. It's not really that important aside from mapping purposes. But you have the countywide school mills, elementary base general fund mills, high school base general fund mills, because in this case we've overlapped elementary school districts with high school districts, so you can look at the big picture, I guess. It's going to tell you your over base general fund mills and then the mills for each different school account: retirement, adult education, transportation, bus depreciation, technology, flexibility, debt service, building reserve, tuition, and then it'll give you the names of the schools as well. And there are some totals here: total base mills, total voted, and total overall. And again, this does not include the 95. If you want to, so this is looking at total. If you just want to look at total general fund base mills, you can click on the left-hand side and click the number 2. And notice nothing changes. So what's happening here is that the map is prioritizing the top of the list. And so in order to see number 2, we can click off number 1. And similarly, if I click number 3, it's not going to show up until 1 and 2 are clicked off. So this is total general fund base mills, elementary base plus high school base. And you're going to see that when this pops up. It's only showing you these two types of mills. So it might help simplify the map if you're just looking for something specific. If we look at the third one, that's just elementary base general fund mills. Again, that's what's going to pop up here. You'll have to re-click if you've changed the map level to see what your, or to update the little pop-up box. And then the fourth one is voted mills. So yeah, I'm going to have to click again. The voted mills in this case are over base, technology, and debt service. And again, you can look at those, and there's a total down here. So you have some different options for how you can look at this map, and you can zoom in and out, and you can select different districts, and it might be something interesting to play with if you're interested in looking at some of these examples more in depth. So unless there are questions about this, I can go back to the presentation and go over those school mills examples.
There we go. There are no questions in the room, and I don't know if there's any anywhere else that show up.
There appears to be no hands raised, but I want to double check with room 152.
No questions from here. Thank you.
Okay. So continue on.
Okay. I will have to reshare my screen. There we go. Okay. So that link can be found right here. Again, if you click it, it'll take you directly there. So at the school district level, we have three of the same sources of variation and then an additional one as well. So we already talked about taxable value per student in Gallatin and Madison counties, but here we're looking at individual districts. So Big Sky K-12 is levying about 109 or 104 mills versus about 21 for NSK 12. And again, the taxable value for the district in Gallatin County is higher than in the district in Madison County. But when you divide that by the number of students, you actually have a higher taxable value per A and B in the NS district. And they need to levy fewer mills to raise the same amount of revenue per student. The second source of variation, which we again talked about at the countywide level, is non-levy revenue. So we have a district, an overlapping elementary and high school district in McMahon County, and an overlapping elementary and high school district in Richland County. And they're levying about 144 mills in Macon, in the district in Macon County, and about 66 in the district in Richland County. So again, the key point to take away here, I've listed the taxable value and the non-levy revenue for each district and the number of A and B. And then we combine the property tax and non-levy revenue per A and B. The amounts are fairly comparable. If we were just looking at property taxes, you have $9,000 per A and B versus about 1,800 for the district in Richland County, but 83 in the district in Macon County in non-levy revenue per A and B versus about 13,000 in non-levy revenue per A and B in the district in Richland County. The third source of variation, which again we talked about earlier, is cost to provide services. This is what I was referencing with transportation. This overlapping elementary and high school district in Garfield County versus one in Yellowstone County. The one in Garfield is levying about 142 local mills versus about 105 local mills in the district in Yellowstone County. The key here is if you're looking at the base mills and over base mills, you have fairly comparable amounts per A and B. However, when you look at transportation and bus depreciation mills specifically, which are associated with, of course, busing students and transportation in more rural areas like Garfield County versus Yellowstone County, this is where you're going to see a larger difference. So about $6,900 per A and B for those mills in the district in Garfield County versus about $2,300 dollars per A and B in the district in Yellowstone County. And then the last source of variation, which isn't as much of one we talked about with the at the countywide level, is local choice. So a good example of this is East Helena K through 12 versus Clancy and Jefferson High School in Jefferson County. They're relatively close to one another geographically. And again, you'll notice if you're looking at the base and over base district general fund mills, the cost per A and B is very close, about $1,400 for both districts. But the East Helena K-12 district is levying about 185 mills, and these are voted mills, for debt service for a new high school, versus zero debt service mills in the district in Jefferson County, because they're not building a new school. And so that amounts for a difference to a difference of about $2,300. So East Helena is has about $2,300 per A and B for those debt service mills versus zero in the district in Jefferson County. So as you heard Pat and Laura talk about, these four sources of variation are constrained by some different statutory limits. And I will turn this presentation back over to Amy if there's anything you want to say here, or I can just move on.
This looks good. There was something I forgot to say that I thought would be interesting. At least it was very interesting to me, so maybe it's interesting to all of you as well, is that of the general fund GTB mills, which is, while there's a substantial variation, there's also a substantial consistency in that particular area. Julia did a calculation for me that basically showed that 90% of the elementary students, so a representation of population, shall we say, in those districts, like 90% of them are between plus or minus 5 mills from 56 mills. So that particular mill levy, that it's a guaranteed tax base aid levy, is very consistent and very, GTB does its job, basically, in other words, except for exceptional purposes. And most people pay that 55 mills or close to it for the guaranteed tax base aid portion. We'll go ahead and go to the wrap up, and then we will wrap this up. So, Julie, if you go to the next slide. Actually, you can just go to the next slide after that because I'm done talking about it. So I think kind of the goal of what Julie and Nick and Megan and Pat and Laura and all of us, I think together, if you have some takeaways, I hope that your takeaway is this, that we have tax statute, that property tax statute, that deals with tax rates, non-levy revenue, reappraisal cycle, and other types of those types of things. And we have funding statute that deals with school funding and local government funding and university and, say, community college funding. So funding statutes that interact with the property tax statute. So you have both different types of statute working together to create a final property tax bill for a final
person that's paying the property taxes. And that can have a lot of different results across the state. And hopefully this, that your takeaway could be just that, that there are those interactions and that all of those things combined create the property tax bill. On the next slide, I'll just give you an example. And I think I'll skip the next example after this, but this is a good example. And Julian's Representative Jones had a conversation about this particular item where the block grants were removed from the district general fund budgets. Those block grants were originally designed to compensate for a property tax adjustment that compensated business equipment taxes that were reduced like 20 years ago. And so those in block grants then were removed 4 or 5 years ago, and then GTB replaced that over a period of years. Well, in the process of that, it was definitely affecting how much different classes of property paid, as the industrial property then had paid more to because they wouldn't necessarily get guaranteed tax base aid. As the guaranteed tax base aid up, it equalized those mill levies, but it didn't necessarily go back to the places that came. Bottom line is that different school fundings can affect effectively tax classes and how much different classes of property pay. And it's relevant backwards and forwards. Likewise, if you change tax property tax class rate changes, it's going to affect schools and local governments. So that's kind of what this interactive slide is talking about. If you want to go to the last slide, just like that same picture again, it's just saying all of those things, all of those different components in statute work together toward the property tax bill. And I guess if you were changing any piece of that, I'd recommend you look at all the pieces to see what's impacted by doing one thing to affect another. And that's the end of what we have to say for our presentation.
Well, thank you very much. We'll ask if anybody has any questions. But don't see any in the room. How about any of the other places?
Mr. Chair, I don't see any hands raised in the Zoom. I'd just like to double check with room 152.
Thank you. And we don't have any questions from here. Thanks again.
Okay. Thank you so much to all our presenters. I think that should probably do it for the day and wrap this up. And again, too many numerous to thank, but your staff. A wonderful job. Representative Beattie has done a good job of lining these up. We've got some more tomorrow. And again, this committee will meet at, I believe, 9 o'clock. I remember right, tomorrow morning we'll meet again here. And we'll do some things on an NCSL presentation and history and flexibility of school funding. So members of the committee, the red or yellow sheets that we did, you want to get them up here and we'll kind of get them in one area. And then we'll deal with those when that shows up down the road. So anything else anybody has? If not, thank you very much, and we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we're back here. Okay, Tax Committee, I guess we're live again in our group. All right, I just wanted to double check with everyone. We are going to have additional presentations from the Legislative Fiscal Division tomorrow, so you'll be hearing more information from what we've heard today, and it's going to start sounding more familiar as we go along. I did want to ask the question, preference by committee members, how would you prefer getting copies of the testimony that we hear during a bill's hearing? Would you prefer it hard copy, or do you want to check your emails or website or the other avenues that we're going to get online? Any suggestions?
Madam Chair, I'd prefer hard copy.
Representative Hinkle, thank you. Any Representative Fielder as well? Hard copies? Hard copies, Sheldon Galloway. Okay.
Soft copies for me. Electronic.
Well, we will eventually have these electronically available, but I think for the time being, we will instruct our clerk, Ms. Sangre, to have hard copies sent out to our desk, our spaces tomorrow. Yes, Representative Malone.
Since I attempted to follow along on Zoom,
the Zoom link dies when we do a joint thing like that or something. They have their own Zoom link of their own, and we don't know what it is.
Representative Malone, I think that if you get dropped off like that, and you see the IT people coming to take care of the desk here, because we were dropped off, you might want to send your homing pigeon up here and say, can you help me down here as well?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Now, for tomorrow, we are going to have executive action on two bills. We do have an amendment coming in that has been requested to be drafted. I believe Representative Dunwell will be carrying the amendment. And we will hear executive action on 52. House Bill 52, Vice Chair Welch. Representative Malone.
I have an amendment, and as a freshman, I don't know what to it's been written up. When do I throw it in the box?
An amendment on one of the bills that we're going to be doing tomorrow?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh. Which bill is that, sir?
The AUM part of whatever, House 52.
We may be only having executive action on one bill tomorrow, but you do need to coordinate that with our staff research analyst, Megan Moore.
I did that part.
Okay.
He wrote it up for me.
All right. So you have it ready to introduce?
I have it ready to introduce.
Okay. So we'll proceed then with House Bill 52. We'll have a couple of amendments going in on those bills tomorrow. Also, tomorrow we will again resume with presentation information from the Legislative Fiscal Division. Vice Chair Welch, what am I forgetting? Oh, bring your snack money. Representative Fielder, did you have anything to ask or add?
I do. With these virtual presentations, some speakers speak very clearly and close to the microphone, and some speak farther back, and they tend to let the end of their sentences sort of drag out, you know, and you can't, it's difficult to understand some of them. So I ask for good speaking efforts on the presenters so we can hear clearly.
Representative Fielder, we're all struggling through this together. When you are experiencing a little bit excessive inability to hear, maybe just give a little hand signal that you can't hear, and we'll try to get that mentioned. Vice Chair Fearn, do you have anything to add?
A question on the logistics of amendments. So I'm assuming that those who want to do amendments are going to contact Megan, request it. She's going to create an amendment, and then somebody here will duplicate it and have it ready to be. Usually we pass out a paper version of that amendment, so she's going to be communicating with someone here to do that. Is that how we think it will work?
Representative Fearn, we have a limitation that if you want to prepare an amendment for a bill that's scheduled for executive action, your amendment has to be submitted 24 hours ahead of that executive action being heard. If you don't have enough time for it to be scheduled in, the actual executive action will have to be postponed to another time, as far as I understand.
But just the communications to get the actual paperwork done. Usually she's here, she's got it here, she's passing it out. So we contact her, then she contacts someone here. It's put together and ends up being on our ready to distribute the day we're going to do executive action. That's just more in the mechanics of it, how it's going to work.
Ms. Moore, Representative Fearn, Ms. Moore will be preparing drafts as she's instructed by our committee because she's typically on. So I would just suggest that you ask her that question when she returns tomorrow morning at our meeting tomorrow. But I do think that we do apparently have a couple of amendments in progress and that will be ready for tomorrow. And then before we go into our executive action, we'll probably break to have, you know, our different chamber or different houses meet together and discuss the bills on the table for the day. So be prepared to have a 5-10 minute meeting tomorrow before we actually proceed with taking executive action. Anything else? We plan to meet here tomorrow morning at 8:30. Meeting adjourned.
Okay.